Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
And if you ask how I know, I got to plead the fifth.
Miami.
City where the heat is on, all night on the beach till the break of dawn.
Welcome to Miami. Bienvenido a Miami.
Dancing in the club where the heat is on, all night on the beach till the break of dawn. I'm going to Miami.
Let's continue our conversation about the heightened tensions in Miami Beach, because we're in spring break right now. And again, tens of thousands of people are out there enjoying the beautiful weather. But, you know, we have seen cases of reports of gunshots. We did have one confirmed death. And again, police at one point used pepper spray balls to disperse a crowd. There is a curfew, by the way, that runs on the weekend, starts at 8 p.m. How is this affecting the city? And how do the residents and businesses feel about everything? Joining us now, WLRN reporters Danny Rivero and Veronica Zaragovia. Guys, thank you so much. I appreciate the time. Veronica, I wanted to ask you about, because you were doing some reporting over the weekend, with this curfew, what did you see and what did you hear from people, you know, especially the businesses and the people who live there?
Well, from the perspective of businesses, I've heard reactions like a restaurant on Washington Avenue that felt really disappointed. They have no business at those hours. And that he was pointing out to me, like, look, we're complete. They didn't have a single patron. This was late afternoon. And a bike rental shop nearby said that they feel disappointed in the amount of potential cancellations they're getting. People worried that Miami Beach has become some like frenzied zone, when really, when I was walking around, it was perfectly fine and safe and people were having a nice time. So I'd say, like, in the post curfew time, people are, that I've spoken to, they are understanding and they feel a bit perhaps bummed that they can't enjoy the restaurants after 8 p.m. on Thursday through Monday morning. But people understand, you know, the people who are maybe most upset right now are the businesses that are really hard hit financially.
Yeah. What else did you see over the weekend? Did anything, I mean, you know, stand out to you compared to other spring breaks?
Well, I would say that actually, as I would visit Ocean Drive over this spring break period, the thing that had caught my attention the most was just the public health problem, that there were a lot of people without masks on. But I also should say that people I speak to, from business owners to officials, say that, medical experts say the problem is this open for business policy that Governor Ron DeSantis has said, that you can't penalize anybody for not following the safety rules. And locals that I spoke to, one couple, they live on 8th and Jefferson, very close to that 8th and Ocean Drive area that's been problematic recently, said that they would like for him to come visit on a Friday night and see what it's like. And it's put a lot of, you know, they like tourists to come. People like and understand that if you live here, this is a touristy area, and that's not the problem. The problem is that now it's just unsafe, especially during a pandemic.
Yeah. Danny, you spoke with a Glendon Hall. He's the chairman of the newly created Black Affairs Advisory Committee of Miami Beach. He was on Ocean Drive and A Street on Saturday night. This is a little bit of what he saw.
The whole day, PD has been doing a great job handling the crowds, keeping everybody peaceful. The Goodwill ambassadors are out there doing all their work. And then within that last half an hour, things fell apart, right? Because we're trying to calm things down. And then this SWAT truck shows up. And it starts escalating stuff. Of course, these guys come out in their gear and their AR-15s walking around. So, of course, what does that do? It doesn't help. And it follows this narrative, you know, that, you know what? When we have events that have Black folk there and people of color, you guys call in the heavy machinery, right? The big guns. And, you know, when you come in with a SWAT, you are telling me now, what are you going to engage in doing right now? What does a SWAT team do? Right? I'm looking at that. And I'm seeing deadly force. Deadly force for twerking? You know? Or maybe some damage in a restaurant, which I'm not condoning it at all. But is that a capital crime?
So, Danny, he's talking again about that SWAT truck, and then things escalated. That's when the pepper spray balls were used. How has law enforcement responded to his concerns?
Right. Well, for this particular incident, the SWAT truck he's talking about was actually from the city of Coral Gables. You know, the city of Miami Beach Police Department and the city has brought in different law enforcement from all over the county and the region to help with the increased police presence on this. So Glennon did tell me that you know, he spoke with the chief of police, Richard Clements, and the chief told him they did not order that. You know, the Miami Beach did not necessarily, is my understanding, want that to be what happened. But the fact is it did happen. And Glennon Hall says that did escalate the situation. And then, you know, shortly after, that's where tear gas was used. And there was, you know, videos of people running, and it kind of contributed to a chaotic situation. When at the time, Glennon Hall, who, like you just said, he was recently appointed to the very newly created Black Affairs Advisory Committee, specifically to help with relations and try to help the city navigate situations like this, because there are a lot of events in Miami Beach that draw large numbers of Black tourism to Miami Beach. Tension with groups like the NAACP, et cetera, it's new. There's also Black residents. So that was just a few cents.
Yeah. Do we know, by the way, Danny, who ordered the SWAT truck?
I do not know that, actually.
Okay.
I do not know that.
All right. Well, something that we can look into. By the way, Danny, there was a news conference over the weekend, and the mayor, Dan Gelber, said that there are more people showing up for spring break this year than in previous years. Do we know that for true?
That is something that is very difficult to fact check, I think you can say. But, you know, there are things that separate this spring break from other spring breaks in the past. I mean, one of the big things is we're deep enough into a pandemic where it's not brand new, it's not novel. There's, you know, a countywide curfew. A lot of big name venues are not operating right now. So the result of that is partly that where you might have 100 parties taking place in different venues and places across the city, a lot of them are shut down, and a lot of them are shut down of their own accord, right? So what might have been a lot of smaller parties over this weekend turn into one huge party in one very, very concentrated area. And that's just different.
Here you see James Craig Anderson in a hotel parking lot as he first comes into view in the lower right corner of the screen. This is after he was beaten, according to law enforcement officials. He staggers into the headlights of Mr. Deadman's truck. The truck backs up and surges forward suddenly, running right over the defenseless man. Take a look again as the approaching headlights glow on Anderson's shirt, then disappears under the truck. According to police, Deadman, with two teenage girls as his passengers, drove to a local McDonald's, meeting up with the rest of the group. There, according to witnesses interviewed by police, he said, "I ran that nigger over."
People were driving much less last year because of the pandemic, but the cars that were on the road were more likely to hit and kill a pedestrian. NPR's Camila Domonoski reports on the troubling trend.
Every day, Laura Foe walks outside her home and draws a chalk heart on the patch of pavement where her mother died.
You know, I can see it from my office window, and so it's nice to be able to see just this bright, beautiful drawings that remind me of my mother, who was also bright and beautiful.
Lucy Lay was walking last summer when she was killed by a neighbor backing her SUV out of her driveway. Some 6,000 pedestrians are killed each year, a huge increase from just a decade ago. Foe has one word for that.
It is a crisis.
A new report from the Governor's Highway Safety Association, or GHSA, found the pedestrian death rate soared even more in the first half of 2020. One factor is likely more speeding on pandemic-emptied streets. But other factors predate the coronavirus. After all, these deaths have been rising for years. Here's Russ Martin with the GHSA.
It's also lack of infrastructure. It's also safety of the vehicles that are out there on the roads.
Popular trucks and SUVs are more dangerous for pedestrians than sedans are. The GHSA says about a third of pedestrians were intoxicated when they were struck, and deaths are more common at night and in warm states. This year, for the first time, the GHSA also broke out racial data and found Black, Native American, and Hispanic people were overrepresented. That's based on several years of data. But Naomi Dorner, an expert on equity and transportation, points out a pandemic connection, too. Essential workers who had to keep commuting are often people of color, and
a lot of those folks are transit riders or pedestrians, bicycle riders.
So more vulnerable to getting hit. Safety advocates emphasize that these deaths are avoidable.
And yet there is silence and no, you know, outcry that we need policy changes and we need them now.
Amy Cohen's 12-year-old son, Sammy, was struck and killed by a vehicle in 2013. Her group, Families for Safe Streets, advocates a range of changes, from lower speed limits to wider sidewalks, to end this crisis. Camila Domonoski, NPR News.
Globalization mandates, of course, on the most powerful white people, these blackouts, you have a totally energy independent state like Texas, plenty of natural gas, oil, gasoline, coal. They were forced to keep up with the mandates and convert up to 20% of their power grid to green energy by 2021. Green energy being wind, solar, hydro, battery, etc. So that 20% freezes over, and the 80% that's left, that always is worth, the oil, the coal, the gas, is not enough to supply the rest of the state. So they have to cut off certain parts of the grid to keep it working. And this is what's going to happen in 2025 when that green energy is mandated to be 50% of the grid. What happens when we have a snowstorm then? And it, what happens in Chicago and New York? I mean, it's cold most of the year here. So it's big. This green energy thing that they've been pushing through this Green New Deal, and 5 years ago, this wanted to happen in Texas. But they were forced to take fully, perfectly functioning parts of their grid and convert it to these green energy. And now that green energy freezes over and the rest of the grid is all vulnerable.
It's been a month since the sweeping failure of the Texas energy grid. Blackouts left millions without power for days, and at least 57 people dead. State officials vowed to get to the bottom of what happened, but that has proven to be a difficult process, politically speaking. We wanted to get an update, so we're joined now by Mose Bushell of member station KUT in Austin. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi. So one of the biggest controversies since this whole failure of the power grid has been over the huge price spikes for electricity that happened during the blackout. Like, that pushed some companies into bankruptcy when they came up short on power and had to buy it from other companies at these inflated prices. So how has the state responded to all of that?
Well, there's been a big push to go back and retroactively lower those high wholesale electricity prices. The state Senate quickly voted to do that earlier this week, but there's a deadline today for the state House to act, and it doesn't look like that's going to happen. But I've got to say that that whole debate has really created a lot of drama. The head of the state's Public Utility Commission, Arthur D'Andrea, he opposed this repricing. And this week, Texas Monthly Magazine released tape of a private meeting between him and Wall Street investors. Now, a lot of investors made a killing off that price spike. And in this tape, you can hear D'Andrea apologizing profusely about that push to reduce the prices. Here's some of that tape.
Yeah, look, I want it to be resolved. I took that first step to tip the scale as hard as I could in favor of it being resolved and that being the status quo. And that's to provide some calming force.
So one result of that call was Texas Governor Greg Abbott asked D'Andrea to step down. So now we're waiting for the governor to find a replacement.
Well, what about other political fallout? Like, right after the storm, there was sort of this blame game over who was really responsible for the whole blackout disaster, right?
Yeah, so D'Andrea was the last person serving on the state's Public Utility Commission. The other two had already resigned. We've also had firings and resignations at the group that operates the state grid. And there's also kind of a question of market manipulation. the Texas Attorney General has opened up an investigation into whether natural gas producers maybe did something illegal to increase the price of gas.
Okay, well, I know that lawmakers are looking more deeply into the cause of the energy system failures. So do we know any more about exactly what happened?
Well, more is coming to light about that, the role of natural gas, whether companies had properly weatherized their equipment, whether oil and gas regulators had done enough to protect the infrastructure. It's also come to light that some gas operators and pipeline companies got their power cut in the blackouts. So that stopped them from supplying power plants. And it turns out that there was an exemption list that they could have put their names on to ask not to get their power cut. But incredibly, it seems a lot of companies just didn't bother with that paperwork.
Wow. All right. Well, lawmakers and the governor have said that they want to make sure this doesn't happen ever again. What would they like to see change at this point?
Well, there are some bills to make power plants more resilient to bad weather. There's also one to prevent those really high electricity bills that you heard about right after the blackouts. But critics say that we're not really seeing the real sweeping overhaul that's needed. They want reforms like starting from the natural gas wells all the way to the light switch at people's homes. And they say if you ignore even one part of that complex system, you're running the risk of another big blackout.
That is Mose Bushell with member station KUT in Austin. Thank you.
Thanks.
I just want to relax, turn my brain off, and watch the blackest city in America beat the most racist city I've ever been to.
Austin is the most racist sports town. It just is. Talk to black players. Hate that place. Don't want to go up.
Boston. And that last one is a real shame, because as I understand it, they only just got unracist yesterday. So, at least they could get to enjoy.
I think Boston is racist.
For the first time ever, Boston is being run by a woman, Kim Janey. Boston City Council president became acting mayor when Marty Walsh resigned to become labor secretary. Adam Riley of member station GBH says she'll bring the mindset of an activist to the role.
Kim Janey will govern a city of almost 700,000. But a few years ago, she was elected to the city council with just 5,000 votes. That's not a knock on Janey, who represents one of 9 districts. Still, she's not a household name. So I asked her, what should people who aren't familiar with you know?
You know, my very first school that I went to was a community school that was started by Black parents and activists who were deeply concerned that Black children were not being well-served or educated in Boston public schools in the 1960s and 70s.
Before second grade, Janey's parents moved her into Boston's school system, where she was told she'd have to repeat first grade. Her parents said no and prevailed.
That was such an important lesson for me, to see them stand up for their child.
At 11, she was bused across the city from her predominantly Black neighborhood to a mostly white one as part of a court-ordered plan to desegregate Boston schools.
We had rocks thrown at our buses and racial slurs and police escorts and the whole nine. Inside that school, you know, we were kids and we were friends with each other regardless of what neighborhoods we lived in.
Later, Janey went to high school in a suburb through a program aimed at giving kids from the city expanded opportunity. At 16, she became a mother and had to go to work right after graduation.
It also meant that people would write you off. And so I had to work extra hard to make sure that my daughter had the opportunities that I wanted for her.
Janey got a job in data entry and went to community college. She transferred to Smith College, but left to care for her grandfather after her grandmother died. She got out of what she calls a dysfunctional, abusive relationship. And eventually, she became a community organizer, most recently with Massachusetts Advocates for Children, where she pushed to reform Boston schools.
Kim is an extraordinarily strong woman. She's deeply respectful of people. Of all kinds.
John Mudd hired Janey at Mass Advocates, where she worked for nearly 2 decades.
We were about empowering people, parents, community members, church members, to make the institutions that represent them respond to their real needs.
Now those same people will be pushing Janey to deliver. It won't be easy, especially in a pandemic. But Janey says given Boston's deep inequities, that can't be an excuse.
Pre-COVID, there's a life expectancy gap of 30 years from Grove Hall to Symphony Hall. It's not enough to go back to normal. I've been a broken record on this. We're not looking, I'm not looking to go back to normal. I want us to go better.
For now, Janie isn't saying whether she'll seek the mayor's job permanently. If she does, she'll have competition. The field already includes three other city councilors, all women of color, and men of Puerto Rican and Cape Verdean descent. Whatever Janie decides, though, her impending promotion will be historic.
My city is going to have its first woman mayor. How incredible is that? My city is going to have its first Black mayor. Wow. And then I think, oh, wow, that's me.
For NPR News, I'm Adam Riley in Boston.
Tell me who paid reparations on my soul. Who paid reparations? Because I don't dig segregation. But I can't get integration. I got to take it to the United Nations. Someone to help me away from this station. Tell me who paid reparations on my soul.
The nation's first government-backed reparations initiative for Black Americans was approved this week in Evanston, Illinois. It's a program that could serve as a model for reparations efforts across the country. John Yang has the story. It's part of our Race Matters series.
Judy, Evanston, Illinois is a suburb on Chicago's North Side lakefront. It's the home of Northwestern University. About 16% of its 75,000 residents are Black. This week, the Evanston City Council voted 8-1 to begin to make good on its promise to spend $10 million in reparations over 10 years. First up, $400,000 to compensate for past discriminatory housing practices. Individual grants of up to $25,000 a person to Black residents who can show they or their families lived in the city between 1919 and 1969. The money can be used for down payments, mortgage payments, repairs, or home improvements. Almost all the money will come from taxes on the sale of recreational marijuana. Dr. Ron Daniels is the convener of the National African American Reparations Commission, and he joins us now. Dr. Daniels, thanks so much for being with us. What's the significance of what Evanston City Council did this week? This has been a topic of discussion for a very long time, but this appears to be the first government to actually do something about it.
The significance is that Evanston now becomes a model. It becomes a blueprint for reparations initiatives across the country. And there are other cities who are quite interested in this as well. So Providence, Rhode Island, Asheville, North Carolina, Los Angeles, Seattle, Washington, there are a number of cities that are interested in this. And so this becomes the blueprint. And it's very significant because beyond the idea of it, we now have a tangible example of moving from idea to public policy, and Evanston has set the tone.
And it's also been a topic of discussion in Congress. There have been discussions about bills that would provide federal, national reparations. Do you think that it's going to give that that effort an impetus as well?
There's no question about it. And there's really a kind of synergistic relationship between Evanston and a number of cities around the country, because many of them have endorsed H.R. 40. Alderman Robin Ruth Simmons, who led the effort in Evanston, certainly was instrumental in getting that done. And at the federal level, the brilliant and courageous leadership of Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee has moved us to the point where I would predict within the next, maybe in the next 3 months or so, we'll actually have a commission set up that will study and develop reparations proposals for African Americans. That's a huge development. It also enjoys the support of Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, Simi Hoyer, and of course, powered by a tremendous coalition of organizations, the American Civil Liberties Union and COBRA, Samuel D. Rip Proctor Conference, National Council of Churches, Human Rights Watch, Center for American Progress. This is an incredible moment in the history of the United States of America.
I want to ask you about the specifics of what Evanston did this week. The one no vote on the city council came from Cicely Fleming. She's a Black member of the council. She argued that the specifics of how this money should be spent was almost paternalistic. She said that the injured party should be the one to dictate and decide what reparations are. What do you think of that?
Well, she's correct. What she's incorrect about is not understanding that the reason why the National African American Reparations Commission certified Evanston as a model is because we were very deeply involved in helping them to put the program together. And when Alderman Robin Ruth Simmons and her colleagues did town hall meetings and hearings across the city, what came back from the persons who are affected was over and over again, housing, 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 housing. And so therefore, that's why the initial reparatory housing initiative was conceived by the stakeholders and went on to the reparations subcommittee and ultimately approved by city council. So I think that the Alderwoman has her right to her opinion, and we think that's good. We need a lot of debate, a lot of discussion. There were others who thought it should be cash payments and so forth. All of that, quite frankly, is positive, because this is not the end of the initiative in Evanston, Illinois. This is really the beginning. There will be many, many other opportunities in order to have reparations initiatives. I should say this, however, the relationship between the national and the federal is it will really take federal legislation to really create the large amount of resources to deal with the injury over the centuries. No amount of money is more enough, or cash or whatever is enough. But at least the federal government, under the leadership of Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee and the coalition I referenced, will be the way in which this ultimately does the kind of repair that's needed.
Dr. Ron Daniels of the National African American Reparations Commission, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Every single thing I can think to do, I was really good. I was really good. I was good. I ain't wanted to be fat like that. I do not want my baby to be fat like that, because I know a black man in America, you can't be like that. I try to... I was trying to tell him, you can't be like that. You can't be like that in America in a black man. I was just...
Kids are getting back in the groove as more schools open for in-person learning and some organized sports resume. But many children, like adults, are returning to the world, how shall we say this politely, less in shape than they were before the pandemic. How to address this with your child, or should you even address that? Joining me now to talk about this is Susanna Stuyvesant. She is a pediatric nurse practitioner at Capital Medical Group in Kensington, Maryland. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Lulu. Thank you.
So data is a little hard to come by because a lot of appointments have been telehealth, right? And we can't get accurate height or weight assessments. But what have you been seeing with your patients?
So what I've seen sort of runs the gamut. I would say we have had children affected and put on the what I refer to as the other COVID-19. Then we've had kids stay the same because they were on elite hockey teams or soccer teams that were able to continue their rigorous training. And then we've even had the other extreme. We've seen some significant eating disorders in much younger patients than we would normally see.
Tell me what that looks like. Why is this happening?
So it's what is not happening. That's not just to refer to the activities and sports that these kids were formerly doing. It's that they lost everything, their entire structure, routine, and regimen. So it left a lot of kids looking for control. And one of the ways that we regained a routine and a schedule within our families was most likely for a lot of people around meals. We saw tons of adults getting into bread baking, right? In my house, I did do the shopping, and all of a sudden there were Cheetos in my house. I never have Cheetos in my house, but all of a sudden they appeared. And this has been a phenomenon that I have seen in lots of houses. So eating became something we could control. And it's also something we use for comfort.
So how do you address this? Because there's a lot of stigma around eating disorders and about medical conditions like obesity. How do you, as a medical professional, address this when kids come in for their appointments? Because you don't want to body shame and you don't want to parent shame, but you do want them to realize how important it is for them to get back to a healthier lifestyle.
It's true. And the thing is that kids know. They know they're heavier than their peers. They know they get out of breath. And so it really comes down to modeling what food is coming into the house. Are the parents active for 60 minutes per day? And especially the older the kids get, I don't think talking about it is useful. And so when I'm talking to kids, I talk about the health risks. And then I say, but I understand that this is really hard to hear. Not only is it a difficult discussion, but you're 16 and I'm talking about type 2 diabetes and heart disease, which are so abstract. And when we're dealing with the abstract, particularly in children who have not completed their psychological developments or might be, you know, stuck at a psychological development, those things are not going to help. And so it really comes down to the modeling and the opportunity. We can control what food comes into the house. And so guess what? I've stopped buying Cheetos, right?
Well, I noticed the way you said Cheetos just appeared as if they had sort of magically been sent by the Cheeto gods. when we know that actually it's something that we do, we bring into the house as parents. What do you think is going to happen as we start to go back to our routines? I mean, do we need massive interventions, or do you think that things might actually stabilize once people are able to get back to what is a sort of normal rhythm of exercise and behavior outside the home?
The good news is I think that a lot of this is going to be seamless. So the screen time rules for kids being 2 hours or less came from the fact that increased screen time correlated with higher weights and BMIs. So what's going to seamlessly happen as we return to our more normal life is less screen time. Because I have even been supporting families saying, okay, playing video games with friends who are, you know, in their own house playing video games, don't consider it screen time, consider it social time. That's going to change next year when I start to vaccinate my 12-year-olds, my 14-year-olds, as we get that safety data, hopefully by the end of this summer for the vaccines. And that in and of itself will likely help this problem to a great degree.
That's Susanna Stuyvesant, a pediatric nurse practitioner based in Kensington, Maryland. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Medical apartheid, the dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
As the summer beckons and vaccines are getting into arms, many people are dreaming of traveling right now. But with the coronavirus pandemic still raging, we may all soon need a different kind of passport to travel anywhere. I'm talking about a vaccine passport or documentation showing you've been vaccinated against COVID-19. In a number of countries, including China and those in the EU, recently announced their plans to implement vaccine passport programs. And in Israel, where half the population is now vaccinated, residents have started using vaccine passports called the Green Pass to do everything from use the gym to eat out at restaurants. And while supporters of the vaccine passport say they'll help us return to some sense of normalcy, some other experts say they may do more harm than good. Nikita Farahani is the Robinson O. Everett Professor of Law and Philosophy at Duke University, and she joins me now. Nita, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What's the primary purpose behind these vaccine passport programs?
I think everybody's looking for a way to be able to safely reopen and try to identify the people who pose the lowest risk to other people. And vaccine passports seem like a promising way for some people to make that happen.
You said they seem like a promising way.
Yes, I have my doubts about it.
Do tell. What are the doubts? It sounds like, right, I've got my card, I've got my passport, I can go. And you have some doubts.
So,
tell us
what
those are.
Well, I mean, so first is just, will they be effective? And, you know, there's some encouraging data about some of the vaccines that suggest that people who have been vaccinated are unlikely to become infected themselves and spread it to other people. But we don't have that conclusive proof yet. What we have is information that shows that if you have been vaccinated, the risk to you of getting severe disease goes dramatically down and the risk of getting sick goes dramatically down. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you don't pose a risk to other people. And so there's this potential false sense of security and false sense of hope that people may have in relying on vaccine passports as the way to reopen. I think it might result in people letting down their guard more than they should, choosing not to do things like social distancing and masking and other kinds of procedures that we've put into place to try to increase safety. So from a safety perspective, I have my doubts, but from an ethical perspective, I have much more serious doubts.
Well, I think that's really where, I think from safety, obviously, is important, but the ethical concerns here,
you know, I've heard people say things like, well, is it fair to have, you know, gatherings or to leave people out or to say, you know, vaccine only, you know, are allowed, for example. Is that what you mean when you say ethical concerns?
It is. So, you know, I think let me start by saying I could imagine a future in which vaccines are widely available to everyone. They have gained full regulatory approval. And we say, under certain conditions, you have to be vaccinated in order to participate in different activities in society. We do that already, right? We have vaccination requirements for schools. We have healthcare workers who have to be vaccinated. So I can imagine some future scenario in which it would be ethical to have a coronavirus vaccine requirement in certain settings. Right now, that's not what we have. We don't have vaccines with full regulatory approval, and we certainly don't have widespread equal access to the vaccines. And so if you start to say, we're going to condition your participation in society on whether or not you have been vaccinated, when it isn't even a choice for many people to be able to get the vaccine, what you have is, you know, a widening gap between the haves and the have-nots, the people who can get early access and the people who can't. And we haven't even prioritized vaccination based on who has been most severely impacted economically by the pandemic. Instead, we've looked, because of the moment of time that we're in, who's at the greatest health risk. Those are the people who are getting the vaccine first, or the people who have figured out how to get the vaccine first, which is generally not the people who've been most disadvantaged by the pandemic to begin with.
There's been an ongoing discussion about those folks on my Facebook page. We're talking about vaccine passports and what it means for us in the near future. It's The Takeaway. The issue here, I wonder if, you know, as you said, not everybody has access to the vaccine. What about questions of privacy? I mean, a lot of these passports might be pieces of paper. A lot of us are getting cards when you get your dose and, you know, the card you can put away. But will some of this be appified, if you will? I mean, will some of this be, you know, information that will be available to people that, you know, can sort of track whether or not we are vaccinated? And does that cross any ethical or health care lines?
Yeah, there are so many ethical and serious concerns for us to consider. We haven't even talked about the differential impact on minorities, but let's focus on this privacy and surveillance issue. So, you know, a lot of times when you have a major crisis, like take 9/11, suddenly there's a rollout of a lot of different procedures and provisions to try to get us to a place where we can safely engage in some of the activities we want to engage in, like travel. The result in the short term is that people are encouraged because it opens up their ability to do the thing that they're scared to do, get on an airplane, know that it's safe, go into a grocery store, go into a restaurant. But the problem is, once you put those procedures in place, they're almost never rolled back. And so with vaccine passports, you see a number of companies, whether it's IBM or Microsoft, you know, earlier on Google and Apple talking about partnerships to do so, different governments who are rolling out these types of passports, who are going to collect your health information. Some of these are entities who haven't traditionally had access to your health information, and they already have a lot of other information about you. What are the safeguards to prevent the commingling of that information? And will there ever be a rollback, right? Once you give that healthcare information to these companies, do you ever get it back? Now, some people might say, okay, but I don't care if people know about my vaccination status. What I worry about is opening up the gateway for these companies who don't have traditional privacy practices for healthcare information. They're not covered entities under our traditional healthcare privacy settings. For those companies to suddenly have access to a lot of this information, it opens the gateway for collecting all kinds of biometric information without any privacy or surveillance safeguards in place.
We talked about the inequities when it comes to privacy, but what about the inequities when it comes to communities of color?
Yeah, this is an area that I'm particularly concerned about. So, you know, first, we've seen in this country that the minority populations have been hit the hardest by the pandemic. And that's true economically as well as in terms of health consequences. And that's, you know, due to traditional inequities in access to healthcare and access to adequate healthcare. But it also, you know, suggests a difference in their ability to do things like work remotely, stay home. They've been in the firing line of the greatest risk. So now, these individuals who could have been prioritized for access to vaccines, and certainly the World Health Organization and the CDC made that recommendation, states haven't done so. And so they're not getting early access to the vaccines, which means that the people who've been the hardest hit by the pandemic are not the ones who are already vaccinated or likely to get vaccinated soon. The result is, if they're the ones who are excluded from being able to go to restaurants, from getting jobs, from being able to participate in the society, you see this widening gap. Some people think, and kind of the early theories were, it was due to significant public mistrust, that there was a hesitancy to get the vaccination. But
I actually think that narrative was a little overdone, frankly.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And in fact, what we're seeing is, it's more likely access to technology, the kind of, who you know and how you can get the vaccine appointments. A lot of people are figuring out through tech, through who they know, through gaming the system, how they can get early access. And that's not true in the population that's been the hardest hit. So I worry that this just means you're going to see an increase in inequities, an increase in the widening gap, which means, putting into place a vaccine passport as a way to gain access to goods and services and jobs means that we're just going to continue to exacerbate the kinds of inequities that the pandemic already introduced.
And we're also not requiring people to get vaccinated. So there are people who could say they don't want to get vaccinated and then really just sort of, be left out entirely, right?
That's true. And, I think for those individuals who can't get vaccinated for health reasons or who have legitimate concerns about the fact that they don't have full regulatory approval yet, it doesn't make sense to say those people can't participate in society. Now, maybe when we get to the point where everybody has access to the vaccine, it's widely available and we have great data that is longer term data about the safety, maybe then we would feel comfortable in certain settings saying everybody needs to be vaccinated for the safety of others.
Is there a way to do this equitably? We've got a minute left.
Well, I'd say at the point at which we can do it equitably, we probably don't need vaccine passports. That is, once we actually have widespread availability of the vaccine such that anybody who wants one can get one, the likelihood of having an unchecked pandemic like this goes way down. And so then, whether or not you have vaccine passports almost becomes irrelevant, because the risk to people of going to a restaurant or going to their jobs or, going to school or participating in everyday normal activities really won't continue to persist, at least we hope. And so, there is a point at which you can do it equitably. I just don't think it'll be necessary when that happens. I think the right answer is we need to focus on making the vaccine widely available to everybody, and we need to figure out a way to enable people to participate in society without conditioning it on their vaccination status.
Nita Farahany is the Robinson O. Everett Professor of Law and Philosophy at Duke University. Nita, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
April 13th of last year, we received a phone call from a listener who called himself T from inside a Westchester County jail.
We're not getting told what's going on. We've been quarantined 14 days. Guys have been catching temperatures in here who are sick. So we understand why we've been quarantined, but no one has been catching temperatures. We're not getting tested in here. And then I've been in here for 4 months. I have not been able to talk to my family. The phones are so high in here. I have not been able to talk to my family. Today is the first time they gave us a $5 prepaid calling card that I was able to call out. And the first thing I wanted to do was call you. I listened to your program. Why can't they follow New York City and make the phone free 15 minutes every 3 hours? We can't talk to our lawyers. We're in here and it's bad. The commissary is so high. We're not getting the right information of what's really going out there. They're keeping us like isolated from what's going on in the world. We're scared here. Guys are getting sick. The officers are getting sick. And it's like nobody's really caring about us as prisoners.
That was one of our memorable callers and calls from last year near the beginning of the pandemic. Caller T from April calling in to plead with our then guest, the New York State Senate Majority Leader, Andrea Stewart-Cousins, to make calls free inside of Westchester County Correctional, as well as Rikers as Rikers and all the New York City jails had done in 2019. The Senate Majority Leader said she would elevate his concern with Westchester County executive, the Westchester County executive who controls that, not the state. And we have since followed up to find out that they are still charging 15 cents a minute for in-state phone calls, which they say is less than the 40 cents a minute they were charging in 2018, and are now providing monthly $5 prepaid calling cards in addition. It's unclear whether the calling cards will outlast the pandemic. Incarcerated people, their families, and other allies have been fighting for what they call phone justice for years. Prison call rates can cost $1 a minute in some facilities, and the phone companies that contract with prisons and jails make big profits. With me now are Yolandis Forte, an activist and grandson of Mrs. Martha Wright Reed, the namesake of the prison phone justice legislation, and Bianca Tylek, executive director of Worth Rises. This segment is part of our series with the Green Space and Worth Rises about the business side of the prison industry. So, Bianca, welcome back, and Yolandis, welcome to WNYC.
Good morning. Thank you.
Hi, Brian.
Bianca, the idea of not being able to afford to make a phone call is striking in any year, but I think this year especially, the phones have taken on this new level of importance for all of us. Listening to T's call from last April, what are you thinking about phone justice in a pandemic year?
Absolutely. I mean, hearing that call, I think, is exactly why we are doing the work we are doing and that we've been doing all around the country. I think, you know, hearing the desperation that was in T's voice is a feeling that I'm sure Yolandis can speak to, but so many can speak to. You know, those of us out here this year have been finding new ways to connect with our families while we can't be there in person. It's an experience that people in prison have had for a very long time, and unfortunately has gotten worse in the last year because of the pandemic. Facilities don't have visits right now in many places around the country, and so where families may have otherwise traveled to facilities to actually see their loved ones for a moment here and there, that's not even an option. So we actually have facilities that haven't had visits for over a year now. And yet with the high cost of calls, communication is, you know, also dwindling as families in particular are struggling financially. So, you know, everything's kind of coming together with this crisis to hurt, you know, more folks and highlight an issue that's been an issue for a very long time.
Yolandis, could you tell our listeners the story of you, your grandmother, and the phones back when you were incarcerated?
Yes, and I'll try to make it brief. First of all, thank you for having me. So my grandmother, who was blind at the time, she's passed now, God rest her soul, she would come and visit me when I was close to home. Once we started moving, when they shut our prison down, our local prison, and start sending us out to federal systems and private prison CCA, that's when we start to have to pay for these ridiculous phone rates. So when we were called home, they would give us, we would get free, prepaid calling cards. And the problem with those cards was you would buy these cards, and when you use them, they would cut off on you, but the price, you would still get charged. If a 15-minute phone call would cost you $15, sometimes $30, and you only talk for 2 to 3 minutes, and there was no one you could talk to about it, anything to correct it. But then it become a point where we would make collect calls, and my grandmother had received phone calls as high, one phone call, 15-minute phone call, as much as $45, one time $60 for one call. It got so bad that my grandmother had to choose whether this month, does she want to pay for this bill in order to continue for us to talk, or does she go purchase her medication that she needs to survive? And it put us in a very terrible spot. And, you know, of course, I would tell my grandmother, hey, Ma, medicine, get your, she didn't want to hear it. She wanted to do all that she can in order to keep me close to home as much as she could, to touch bases with the real world. What people don't know is that you...
Yes. Go ahead. No, you go ahead. What people don't know is what?
Yeah, what people don't know is that being in touch with the outside world, it really helps keep you grounded. You know, as I was telling Bianca, that, you know, some of the prisoners would call my grandmother their grandmother and would live through me and my grandmother's relationship because they didn't have anybody. They couldn't afford to talk to anyone. I've seen people go crazy. I've seen people commit suicide. You know, I've seen so many things that people couldn't handle because they didn't have anybody who really loved them. That's why they have a brotherhood in prison, because they don't have anybody else to turn to, because they can't afford to be communicating with their family. Why make your family suffer? Okay, maybe I did do something wrong, but my kids, my mother, my grandmother shouldn't be able to suffer because of my wrongdoing. That's like double jeopardy. Allow me to reach out and get some therapy from people that I know. It goes so far. It is so helpful.
And I believe your grandmother has some legislation named after her, the Martha Wright Reed Act. What's in it, and how did that come about?
Okay, so it came a time when my grandmother was just so frustrated with the price of the phone calls. We were getting two different bills, one from a regular phone company and one for these collect calls, which, you know, nobody to this day still can explain why this thing was happening. But she just got sick and tired, and she just reached out to legal aid and to the legal prisons. And Deborah Golden, a few other good people, came to our rescue in order to formulate a plan that we need to attack these people and stop them from advantage taking and doing what they were doing to us, because it was wrong. And from that point on, the fight started, you know. And my grandmother died in January.
Oh,
go ahead. No, please jump in.
No, go ahead. Yeah, Elandis, I'll jump in after you're done. Go ahead.
Yeah, my grandmother passed on my birthday, January 18th, in 2015. And it's like, you know, from then, the torture has really been lit behind me. Whenever I get a phone call, whenever I get an email, anything that has to do with this situation, I'm on it. It's not even a second guess. It's not even a thought. Whatever I need to do in order to be able to be a part of this great movement, I'm there.
Bianca?
Yes, and we're so thankful to Elandis and to Elandis's grandmother for, you know, for this fight. And this fight has been a long time coming. And in the last few years, we've really started to see the wins that were built on the back of that incredible effort that Mrs. Wright had. You know, and the fortitude of Elandis to continue that fight. Just to give a little bit of color to the federal legislation in her honor and with her namesake, it is legislation that would increase the regulatory authority of the Federal Communications Commission. So what a lot of people may not know, listeners, is that the way that prison phone calls runs is a little bit odd. It's pretty old school. It's still done on a toll rate basis, which means you pay per minute. Almost nothing else in society exists like that in communications today. But in prisons and jails, it does. And the FCC, which tried to, under Commissioner, when Commissioner Clyburn was still there working with Mrs. Wright Reed, they tried to regulate the cost of prison and jail phone calls. Unfortunately, a case came down and decided that the FCC does not have authority to regulate what they call in-state calls. And so it can only regulate interstate calls. Interstate calls is essentially what we used to refer to as long-distance calls, calls where two area codes are in two different states, the caller and the recipient. In-state calls are essentially what we would call like local calls, calls where the two area codes of the caller and the recipient are in the same state. And so the FCC, because of federal limitations of federal authority, can only regulate interstate calls and cannot regulate right now in-state calls.
And that would leave out most prisoners and their families, because typically you are sentenced by a state court for a crime that you committed in the state in which you live. And the jail or the prison would be in the state in which you live and where your relatives probably live in most cases. And therefore, that federal legislation doesn't actually help with this for most prisoners, it would sound like, Bianca, right?
Right. Well, not the legislation. The legislation would change that. So the current situation is that, right? And it's actually 80%. That exact number is 80%. 80% of calls are in-state and therefore not regulated by the FCC. And what the bill would do that's currently in Congress is it would give the FCC, very simply, the regulatory authority over all prison and jail phone calls.
There's nothing wrong with black people that ending racism can't solve.
Are black Americans more skeptical about getting the COVID-19 vaccine than people in other demographic groups? A poll from NPR, PBS, and NewsHour tells us no, they are not. But in all communities, there is some skepticism. Politicians, health officials, and journalists have been talking about an infamously cruel medical study to explain why some black Americans might be skeptical.
Because of things like the Tuskegee experience.
The Tuskegee experiment.
The Tuskegee experiment.
Remember Tuskegee? Is this the federal government trying to fool you again?
But some advocates say all of this emphasis on Tuskegee may be overplayed because there are plenty of current examples of unequal treatment in the healthcare system. Here's April Demboski from KQED.
The focus on Tuskegee to the exclusion of contemporary inequalities bothers Maxine Toler. She's 72 and lives outside Los Angeles. Toler talks with her friends and neighbors about the vaccine all the time. She's black, they are, and hardly anyone brings up Tuskegee. Toler says the handful that do are fuzzy on the details.
If you ask them, well, what was it about and why did you feel like it would impact your receiving the vaccine now, they can't even tell you.
Most people she talks to cite very current reasons for not wanting the vaccine. Religious beliefs or safety concerns, or they think the former president rushed it for political gain. Toler calls the Tuskegee references a distraction, irrelevant even.
It's almost the opposite of Tuskegee because they were being denied treatment, right? And this is like, you know, we're pushing people forward, like go and get this vaccine.
She says the point of Tuskegee was to study what happened when syphilis went untreated. It began in 1932 with about 400 black men who had the disease, but they didn't know that.
And they weren't told that they had it and they didn't get any treatment for it.
Even when a cure, penicillin, became widely available in the 1940s, government doctors withheld it from the men for another 25 years.
Because the people involved, the white people involved, wanted to see how sick they were going to get.
By the time the study was exposed and shut down in 1972, 128 men had died from syphilis or related complications. 40 wives and 19 children were infected. With a horrific history like this, you might assume that black people would lose trust in the medical system, or at least avoid participating in clinical trials. Over the next three decades, various books, articles, and films repeated this assumption over and over.
That was a false assumption.
Dr. Reuben Warren is in charge of bioethics at Tuskegee University in Alabama and is a former associate director of minority health at the CDC. He says starting in the 90s, researchers began hunting for evidence that black people would not participate in research. Over the course of a dozen years, they completed 17 studies, including surveys of thousands of people across several cities, from Baltimore to San Antonio to Tuskegee. The conclusions were definitive.
The hesitancy is there, but the refusal is not. And that's the important difference.
While black people were more wary of participating in research compared to white people, they were equally willing to actually participate if they were asked.
Hesitant, yes, but not refusal.
Tuskegee was not the deal breaker everyone thought it was. Warren says this did not go over well at the CDC and in other research circles.
Much of it indicted and contradicted what the government said.
Now researchers had to confront the real problem. Many of them never invited black people to participate in their studies in the first place. When they did, they didn't try very hard. Tuskegee was a scapegoat.
That was the excuse that they used to not include black and other communities of color in the research enterprise. If I don't want to go through the extra energy resources to include the population, I can simply say they were not interested. They refused.
Warren says many of the same presumptions that were made about clinical research are resurfacing now around the coronavirus vaccine. A lot of hesitancy is being confused for refusal. USC sociologist Karen Lincoln says Tuskegee is once again being used as a scapegoat.
It's an excuse. If you continue to use it as a way of explaining why many African Americans are hesitant, it almost absolves you of having to learn more, do more, involve other people, admit that racism is actually a thing today.
The memory of Tuskegee is still very present for some people. But Lincoln says it's the contemporary failures of the healthcare system that are causing more distrust than events of the past.
It's what happened to me yesterday,
not what happened 50 years ago. Lincoln works with an advocacy group for African American elders. She says seniors complain to her all the time about doctors dismissing their concerns or nurses answering the call button for their white roommate more than them.
And the word travels fast when people have negative experiences. They share it.
Like the Facebook Live video of Susan Moore that went viral. Moore, a Black doctor with COVID, said she had to beg her physician to give her remdesivir, the drug that speeds up recovery from COVID. She was wearing her hospital gown, sitting in her hospital bed near Indianapolis, an oxygen tube in her nose, as she spoke into the camera on her phone.
She said, you don't need it. You're not even short of breath. I said, yes, I am. He further stated, you should just go home right now. I put forward and I maintain, if I was white, I wouldn't have to go through that.
Dr. Moore died 2 weeks later. It's stories like these that stoke mistrust. Dr. Reuben Warren says if you want to shift that, if you want Black people to trust doctors and trust the vaccine, don't blame them for distrusting it. The onus is on the health institutions to listen, to be accountable, and make the vaccine easy to get.
Prove yourself trustworthy, and trust will follow.
Warren says Black people will come when institutions and officials take responsibility and stop making excuses. For NPR News, I'm April Dymbosky.
That story came from NPR's partnership with KQED and Kaiser Health News.
Tomorrow, leaders from Facebook, Twitter, and Google will testify again before Congress. The subject, rampant disinformation on their platforms, ranging from lies about the 2020 election to the COVID-19 rollout. New reporting from NPR out today shows that a specific type of story about vaccines has been spreading quickly online and may be leading to increased hesitancy. NPR's Miles Parks is here to explain. Hey there.
Hey, Ari.
So what is this new data and what does it show about vaccine misinformation?
So we analyzed the types of news stories that have gotten the most engagement on social media this year using data from this media tracking firm called NewsWhip. What we found was basically that the stories specifically about people who have died sometime after being vaccinated went viral at a really high rate. Now, health officials have obviously found no connection between these deaths and the shots they received. But these are stories with headlines that don't say that. They say basically, person gets vaccine, dies 2 weeks later, and people who were probably already hesitant of vaccines are spreading those articles on social media as if they're evidence. We found Facebook pages with tens of thousands of followers sharing these articles with captions like, quote, I'll pass on the vaccinations, or, quote, very concerned about those getting the poke.
So this obviously is not showing anything representative or backed by science, but like just how far out of the mainstream is it? How far are we talking?
Yeah. So what's interesting is that, like you said, very few vaccinated people have actually died. Something like 0.0018%, according to the CDC, have died after getting their shot. And that includes elderly people, people who already were suffering from other health conditions. But online, you get a very different picture. The vaccine story with the most engagement so far in 2021 was not about the vaccine rollout or about new trial research. It was about someone who died a couple weeks after getting a shot. One of these stories has ranked near the top in engagement almost every other day this year.
Hmm. And what do we know about the effect that that has on people consuming these stories?
So research shows that people generally are pretty bad at assessing risk, but that's especially true after they hear a vivid story. I talked to Dean Freeland, who's a communications professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
This is something that we see, I think, repeatedly with human cognition, the emphasis on the breathless anecdote and then the discounting of statistics.
You know, there's just no way that if you're one of these people who either commented, liked, or shared one of these articles that connects vaccines to death, that you're going to be more likely to get a vaccine, even though, again, there has been no scientific connection between the two things.
But it's interesting that he calls it a breathless anecdote, which is different from an outright lie, and I would imagine makes it tougher for these big tech companies to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. He basically made the distinction of it's not really disinformation, but it is a fallacy. I also talked to Brett Schaefer, who studies online disinformation at the Alliance for Securing Democracy think tank. What he told me is he thinks about it as lying through truth. A recent report he co-authored found actually that Russia has started using this tactic online more and more.
It's this sort of malinformation and use of selectively cherry-picked truth to create this completely warped sense of reality. And the end effect is essentially the same as a false narrative.
Now, executives at Facebook have alluded to this being a problem, but they also say there isn't a clear solution when it comes to policing how people relay true information. Tomorrow, the leaders of Facebook and Twitter are testifying in front of Congress. And it'll be interesting to see whether this trend, gets asked of them about, how are they going to respond.
That is some original reporting there from NPR's Miles Parks. Thank you so much for your insight.
Thanks, Ari.
Drink, 85 cents. You pay or go.
What's a phi? I don't understand a phi. There's a V in the word. It's five. You don't got V's in China?
Not Chinese. I'm Korean.
Whatever. You come to my country, you take my money, you don't even have the grace to learn how to speak my language. You're Korean.
Huh?
You have any idea how much money my country has given your country?
How much?
I don't know. It's got to be a lot. You can bet on that.
You go now. No trouble.
I stay. What do you think of that?
A week ago today in Georgia, a man went on a shooting rampage, killing 8 people at 3 Atlanta area spas. 7 of the victims were women, and 6 of them were immigrants from Asian countries or Americans of Asian descent. And right away, Americans wanted to know if the killing was racially motivated. While we wait for new details to emerge and for the whole story to be told about this specific attack, it is becoming clear that anti-Asian violence is on the rise in our country. In New York City, the NYPD reported 28 arrests in connection with hate crimes against people of Asian descent in 2020, compared with just 3 reported arrests the year before. And in late August, the United Nations released a report describing, quote, an alarming level of bias crimes against people of Asian descent in the United States, with some of those assaults linked to racist rhetoric around China and COVID. With me now to talk about why this is happening and what it all means is WNYC's Arun Venugopal. He's a senior reporter with our newsroom's Race and Justice Unit and leads the station's reporting on bias and hate. Arun, welcome back to All of It.
Hi, Ilya. Thanks.
Arun, I want to start with the crime that prompted all this self-examination in the first place. It's a week since Robert Aaron Long went on a rampage around Atlanta. And really, for the first time in a while, there has been sustained attention on anti-Asian bias crimes. So what do we know big picture about the rate that these crimes are happening, where they're happening, what kinds of crimes are happening?
Well, Ilya, definitely we've seen an increase since early 2020, even before the pandemic really landed in the U.S., just the rising concern about the pandemic and the language that was employed by former President Trump and his allies, which was really trying to put the focus on China, And, you know, the kind of xenophobic language that he used started causing a lot of alarm within Asian American communities. Even before, say, March, you started seeing and hearing from people who were experiencing bias incidents. Definitely on both the coast, you heard a lot of that kind of concern emerging. And that means that even in cities like New York, which have large numbers, you know, hundreds of thousands of Asian Americans, you're seeing this very unsettling rise in incidents of all these different kinds. You know, there's a group called Stop AAPI Hate, AAPI meaning Asian American Pacific Islander, and they were documenting that in cities like New York, you're seeing an extraordinarily high sort of response rate from Asian Americans when it came to sort of confirming incidents. Some of this is verbal abuse. That's the most kind of common thing. Somebody might get shouted at, you know, said, you know, you are COVID or you have it or whatever. And then physical assaults were happening. It's very specific categories and very unsettling categories like being coughed at or spat upon, things like that are happening, happening in public transit. And so this is not necessarily a new problem. It's been going on for, you know, a good 12, 15 months now, but it is these incidents in Atlanta and a few incidents prior to that in the last few weeks, really, that have brought it to national prominence. But certainly well before that, you have people in a lot of communities across classes, working class, as well as, you know, people who are doctors who are very successful, who have been reporting this and have changed their behavior.
And we are talking about bias crimes. What do we know right now about the motive of the gunman in Atlanta? Is it possible to say why he went on this rampage or what he thought he was doing?
No, and this really gets at the heart of the national debate over this. His motives, which have not been overtly or explicitly stated as anti-Asian hostility, and point to the problem of confirming that something is a hate crime versus a crime. Now, he is facing murder charges. He has 8 counts of murder that he's facing. So one could say, like, isn't that enough? But the thing is that hate crime charges, which are in most states now, but were only most recently passed hate crime statutes in Georgia just a year ago after the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, you know, who was stopped and shot to death by these, you know, white residents, essentially these white vigilantes in the neighborhood. They kind of carry a lot of political import in addition to the additional years that someone may face in sentencing that kind of confirms, I guess, the status of a community, if you will, in terms of their position as victims and on the receiving end of hate. So this is a political battle in some regard because it kind of confirms, you know, the import or the importance rather of specific communities and groups, whether it's LGBT or ethnic or racial minorities, in terms of the antagonism and the violence that they face often on a daily basis. So this is really what it's getting at. And it's very difficult to get some of these things prosecuted. There's a lot of pressure now in the Biden administration to get involved. And the thing is that a lot of federal hate crime charges, mostly they do not translate into actual prosecutions. So whether it's a local prosecutor or somebody at the federal level, there's a lot of reluctance. And that also gets down to the political game of how much pressure can be exerted on law enforcement and political officials to sort of get involved.
Is that because it is difficult to prove intent? Is that the reason for prosecutors' reluctance?
Exactly. That is part of it. Certainly, you know, this is the reason why when you mentioned that figure earlier on, 28 hate crimes incidents reported by police last year, that's the NYPD specifically, versus 3 the year before. On one hand, that's a huge spike, you know, 800 and something percent increase from one year to year. On the other hand, you could say, wait, 28, is that a big number? And this gets at the fact that that's just a tiny subset of the kinds of incidents that we see playing out across communities in cities like New York, a huge population, 8.5 million people. Is 28 a big number or not? And we have to kind of put that in the larger context. It's very difficult to have something get categorized as a hate crime incident, because it does require law enforcement officials and prosecutors require something very explicit and overt. And this is a frustration you see from the Asian American community right now, is that the high threshold in some ways, they see it as invalidating the experience that they're facing, like on a daily basis.
My name is Ilya Meritz, in today for Allison Stewart. You're listening to All of It, and my guest is Arun Venugopal from the WNYC Newsroom. He is tracking the very troubling rise in anti-Asian American and anti-Asian bias crimes. And as you said, Arun, that number is up from 3 in 2019 to 28 in 2020, as reported by the New York Police Department. Is it safe to assume that the true number of crimes targeting our Asian American fellow citizens is a lot higher?
Yeah, and there are different organizations that are tabulating those figures. Locally, the Asian American Federation has put that figure at around 500 from early 2020 to February of this year, and they're adding on more, with each day, that sometimes people come forward well after the fact and say, I guess what happened, something happened to me. I should, they didn't necessarily know where to go. And you can imagine, especially in communities where English is not necessarily, widely spoken, if something happens to someone, say a senior, she doesn't speak English. There is one particular incident that comes to mind, someone in Brooklyn who these two young men, they tried setting fire to her, the cops afterwards said, she didn't say that anything was said explicitly. Now, the problem is she did not speak English. So was something said? And how else do you, for the community's perspective, how else do you view an incident where someone was almost set fire to? Other incidents where people thrown acid on, there's really terrifying incidents playing out so often. All of this stuff is internalized. So when the focus is on, do we really know his motives, say the shooter in Atlanta, I think for some members of the community, that's seen as a bad faith effort to undermine, the prosecution, at least in the public eye, and to say, we don't really know. I mean, he had a sex addiction. So this isn't about race, although he went to three different sites and the majority of the victims were Asian American women. So it plays into these long standing kinds of forms of misogyny, racism, erasure, and the fact that we know, many people know a lot more about the alleged killer than they do about any of these victims, which itself is, I think for many people, just a tragedy.
And we can take your calls on the rise in anti-Asian crime, particularly in New York City. We would love to hear from you, particularly if you're a part of the Asian American community, if you have been targeted or someone who you care about has been targeted, we would like to hear your story. The number to call is 646-435-7280. That's 646-435-7280. So Arun, what have you learned as you have started to look closely at what is happening in New York City? That number has risen a lot, but what form do these kinds of crimes take? Who are they targeting? Where is it happening? I think so many New Yorkers think of our city as this, spectacularly tolerant place, but obviously that's not the whole story.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're right. I think it's, I'll admit to being just as kind of sort of unsettled by this incredible, sharp rise in incidents targeting, people in neighborhoods across the city, really. And this definitely is happening in Asian majority neighborhoods. You see these, videos being posted on social media of people in the middle of Flushing or, in lower Manhattan in the middle of daylight, where lots of people walk around. And, this one woman was going to a protest on Sunday, one that I attended and covered, and she was on her way. She was in Astor Place, and somebody saw her sign, asked her what it was, and then he stomped on it. And when she asked, why'd you do that? He punched her twice in the face. And, she was there with her small child. So that kind of violence is happening different hours. It's happening in different neighborhoods, but a lot of it is happening in Asian majority neighborhoods. And so there's this sense, at least from the perspective of community members, that they are seen as vulnerable, easy targets, that the community won't, the broader community, that is, New Yorkers won't necessarily rally to their side, that law enforcement won't necessarily take it seriously, that the political establishment is not going to really, see it with the urgency that's required. And that's also, a product of the kind of xenophobic language that we've seen, not just under former President Trump, but in all the kind of cultural imagery and tropes we've seen play out for decades, the jokes that are made, the misogynistic jokes about Asian women, things we're hearing right after the fact in Atlanta, the kinds of, really demeaning jokes that happen about the sites, these massage parlors. These are so deep rooted in American society. And so it is kind of, I think, scary for a lot of New Yorkers that this is happening everywhere. And there's still not clear answers. How do you address these problems, because it's really in the bloodstream of the society.
I say that there can't be racism, white supremacy without mass murder. Killing, like the majority of people that are being killed on the planet are non-white people. And they're all being killed by weapons manufactured by people who classify themselves as white. In a global system of racism, white supremacy. See, where the gun is considered, you've got a problem, then get the gun. You got a problem, too many people of color, get the gun and start killing tens of thousands. Set up situations where you are justified in killing, which is, parallel to stand your ground. If you're afraid, you're justified in killing a black person. You thought they had a weapon. They didn't have a weapon, but you thought they had a weapon. So you're justified in killing them. This is what the entire culture has to look comprehensively at itself.
Despite the social distancing, curfews, and quarantines, mass shootings actually went up in 2020. According to the Gun Violence Archive, the number rose nearly 50% from 2019. And J. Brian Charles of The Trace writes that these mass shootings took place disproportionately in Black and brown communities and haven't drawn the same attention as the most recent mass shooting in Georgia, for example. He joins us to talk about his research into why. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Let's get into the definitions of what we're talking about. I use the term mass public shooting, which was in your article. What's the unfortunate threshold for death, so to speak, and how do you define this?
So a mass shooting is an incident in which four or more people are injured in one event. For example, a mass shooting can be a scenario where somebody does not know any of the potential victims and walks into a room and or a place and then fires off their weapon and injures four or more people. A mass shooting could also be a scenario in which somebody is familiar with the people that are the potential victims and still injures four or more people. One is based, the latter example is the one in which someone actually has an existing conflict. The former example is one in which the conflict is not clear prior to the actual shooting.
When you started to do research into this and you found this increasing tally, where were these shootings taking place?
So we looked at several cities across the United States, and our research went through September of 2020 when we published our story. We were already on pace by September to eclipse the number of mass shootings nationwide than we had reached in previous years. But if you looked at a place like Chicago, they had 36 mass shootings through September 2020. 31 of those were in majority Black neighborhoods.
And how did the pandemic affect these figures? We've seen some reports that violent crime is up specifically in some cities, even though overall crime might be down. Can you help me kind of get our arms around that?
There's a couple things that I think a couple criminologists have pointed to. The first thing is you have this pandemic, you have this this disease that is spreading. You don't know how. It's kind of this invisible enemy. And you would get this kind of retreat and this pullback from regular law enforcement going in and communicating with people on the ground face to face. They're worried about contracting a coronavirus. They're worried about spreading it. The second thing is, and in communities that are often affected by large amounts of violence, we have kind of non-law enforcement responses to that, street outreach workers. They found it very hard to do their work because they couldn't go do things like go into a home and do a home visit because you can't go in someone's house.
Is there something to be said for isolating and focusing on shootings like the ones we saw in Georgia, which, you know, happened in an area where it was unusual, and to victims who are not, air quotes, typical targets, right? Isn't that sort of the distinction that law enforcement or investigators or the media is drawn to? And should those things be treated differently?
I don't think they should be treated differently, because if you're the victim of one of these crimes, it doesn't really matter, right? I think that we have a responsibility to try to get as much information about why our neighbors, our family members, our people in other communities, our, you know, our people who live in our country are being subjected to high levels of violence. So I think we can do both. And I think that we should do both. And I think we should spend time with all of these things. And I know it is, there's a natural thing that attracts us to, we always look at the thing that's very different all the time. And sometimes it's the thing that's the same that shows a pattern of behavior or a pattern of activity that draws us to a larger trend that makes us go, well, why does this keep happening? And that's the real story.
J. Brian Charles, thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Context of White Supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, March 27, 2021. So I have been told. Always wonderful to hear from Dr. Welsing, the grandsester, and again, all of the talk about anti-blackness, numerous cows listeners saying that the recent anti-Asian violence, put that in air quotes as they say, that these reports have motivated them to go back in the archives and listen to some of the content that we've done on so-called or anti-blackness from individuals classified as Asian. One of those programs, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, in fact, she did two programs with us where she discussed Elliot Rodger, the 2014 massacre in Southern California. Cowbell there for Elliot Rodger. But the segment that we heard where she was talking about those mass shootings, that is from her discussion on Elliot Rodger. Profound. And I'm even... whew, not bragging, stand by your work. It is accurate. Dr. Welsing requested to come on the cows to discuss the Elliot Rodger situation. In fact, I remember calling her at 5 a.m. Pacific time because I knew it would be 8 p.m. Eastern and she would be awake, which she was. And we talked about the Elliot Rodger case, man. It was already spring, so the sun was up here. But, I mean, that was a great way to start a day. Anywho, context of white supremacy, compensatory call-in. If you have thoughts, questions, suggestions, the number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Things to share before we get rolling. My goodness, what a week on the plantation. Every week you can only play a very small sample of some of the things that have happened, mostly in the U.S., but I mean the world, known universe, you know, nothing. So you just try to get a little bit of some of what has been discussed. Didn't even get to talk about in the state of Virginia, the coon man, Governor Ralph Northam, bragged about abolishing the death penalty 400 years of executing black people. Remember, we did the we had the white author on the cows back in 2016. We discussed the 20th century. I believe they executed a black female. Her name was Virginia. I have to look up her last name, but they executed her. They accused her, convicted her for killing a white woman. We had the author on the program way back when. I'll have to go back and get her name in the program. But no more death penalty, and that will go down. The Coon Man resurrected his career. Anyway, but that wasn't even in the sound clips. I've been saying Muhammad Ali. I've been thinking of quite a bit of late. Marvin Hagler just passed away. Thinking of him. Pamela Evans Harris as well. I got Dr. Gerald Horn's book, The Bitter Sweet Science: Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing. Cowbell, because he has Jack Johnson on the front cover in front of a crowd of angry white people, mostly white men. But I got the book. Dr. Horn is coming on the program on Wednesday, right at the end of the month. I had my whole big spiel together, like white guests only. Just said that we had Judith Finlayson, white woman in Canada, on the program this past week. And, you know, we've had that policy now for, I think, at least seven, 8 months or so. And I've said that even since I've been saying that, we had listeners who would write in and insist, you know, not sometimes it'd be a non-white person who looks like they have constructive information, maybe. Sometimes it's been non-white people who often act, often it's been victims of racism who are in some sort of tragic sexual situation with a white person and that sort of thing. So, white guests only. I was all excited to get to emphasize that again. It's like, oh yeah, and then Dr. Horn will be coming on the program, returning this week. And I did add, he is what they call it, grandfathered in. I think they say that when they have a change in policy that might prohibit some of the things that used to be, but they will allow it because these people have been participating for a long time. So they'll say, we'll so-called grandfather that. And I think that term is even connected to racism, white supremacy, and keeping black people from being able to vote. Metaphors are important. And most of them, as I've said, are related to white supremacy, racism, directly or indirectly. But I'm real willing to put some nickels down that that is what grandfathered is connected to, ways that we will make some allowances for illiterate white people so that they and their ilk can vote, but then we can turn around and say, oh no, nigger, you're ignorant, you don't know the laws and all the rest of it, you're heathen, get out of here. Anywho, so Dr. Gerald Horn, grandfathered in, he will be returning to the clouds this week to discuss The Bitter Sweet Science, which features Muhammad Ali, Marvin Hagler, all in the very first chapter of the book, no less. So I'm reading the book and loving it. Man, reading is more important than watching television, especially when you get to read a good book, and a good book that happens to be about racism. I got to read two really good books this week, You Are What Your Grandparents Ate, and then reading now The Bitter Sweet Science. And I love Dr. Horn. He makes it so explicit that this is not a book about boxing and ooh, that jab that George Floyd has and ooh, that Floyd Mayweather is slick. He does mention Floyd Mayweather early too. That's not what this book is about. This book is about racism in the industry of boxing. Phew. What could be better? Let's see. I'll share a snippet of what I read today. So, if you remember, Dr. Horn was with us when we didn't have a whites-only guest policy. He said, I just finished writing this book. And I was like, whoa, that's crazy. It's out. And he's like, no. Too excited. Be out next year. And I was like, oh, okay. That'll give us something to look forward to get through the Rona and everything. And I said, wow, let me try to guess who's in the book. Sonny Liston. He said, oh yeah, Sonny Liston's in the book. Page 23, he writes, Sonny Liston did not gain many fans among a generally conservative Euro-American majority already beginning to grouse about the onset of desegregation when, upon returning to the U.S. from London in September 1963, that is 2 months before the Kennedy assassination, he announced that he was ashamed to be in America, according to an observant reporter. He was upset over the Sunday bombing of a Negro church in Birmingham. This was not necessarily a sectional dispute, in that his opponent, Floyd Patterson, felt compelled to tell his home in what was described as a white area of This was not necessarily a sectional dispute, in that his boxing opponent, Floyd Patterson, felt compelled to sell his home in what was described as a white area of Yonkers, New York, since no one wanted to play with my children. In fact, people have called my kids nigger, Sambo, and worse. Now, I have no idea what is worse than nigra, Sambo, spear chucker, I would need some help. If anybody has any guesses as to what black children could be called that would be worse than Negro or Sambo, Gus would like to know. Continuing, a notably malicious neighbor trained a dog to deface his property. I tried, said the heavyweight of this experiment in desegregation, but it just didn't work. What was at play was a wider experiment to see if African Americans, now being buoyed by the tide crashing against Jim Crow, could be accepted as class comrades in more affluent areas long after long decades pointing in an opposing direction. I'm skipping over to the next page. We talked about Marvin Hagler and whether or not he had brain damage and all that. He fought for a long time, had over 50 fights. He writes, boxing involved battering and ultimately led to untold damage to the skulls, brains, and bodies of contestants. The analyst Joyce Carol Oates has argued that 87% of boxers suffer brain damage during their lifetime, while from 1945 to 1985, Marvin Hagler fought during that period, 370 pugilists died from injuries directly attributable to the sport. I'm going to pause right here just because the footnote to this is staggering, but I'm pausing because I posted the video of Marvin Hagler winning the middleweight championship against Alvin Minter. We talked about it on the Global Sunday Talk because this fight happened in England. He wins the championship. The white men in the crowd terrorize him. They're throwing items, calling him names, and white terrorism, you know, same thing. So they escort him out of the ring, and Howard Cosell is doing the color commentary, and he says, that's disgraceful. And he says, this is common behavior, you know, talking about behavior patterns. He says, this is common behavior. Yeah, they do this all the time. And he says, that was a great stop. The referee stopped the fight because Minter was bleeding really bad and all the rest of it. So he stopped the fight. He says, that was a great stop. That was a great stop. There have been 6 fighters to die in the ring. That was a great stop of the fight right there. I was stunned. This was said casually, just like, yep, we've already had 6 fighters die in the ring. Don't want to, you know, add to that total anytime soon. Beastly. Do I want to read any more? He goes on to just give more about all the damage and, you know, what they've seen. But the footnote is what was stunning from all of this. So footnote 102, Joyce Oates on boxing. For the Village Voice, boxing analyst Bert Sugar has argued that according to a 1979 study by the American Medical Association, amateur and professional boxing was behind in fatalities with 0.13 deaths per 1,000 compared to college football at 0.31. Still, for massive detail on the fatalities and injuries that have beset boxing, and then he gives different reports so you can check all that out. And then he has a quote from one of these studies. Statistics show that black Statistics show that professional boxing rates behind some 10 sports in the number of fatalities. There was a tragic number of deaths, 39, in the United States last fall in football in a period of 10 weeks, including 28 high school students, whereas the record shows that in the entire year, 1961, there were 10 deaths covering the world, including such important boxing areas as the United States, England, Japan, Philippines, Mexico, Chile. I think I've said for a long time, football is ridiculous, beastly as well. They need to totally abolish that as well. I said for a long time, black parents, non-white parents should not allow their children to play football. Brain damage. That's what you are signing your child up for. Brain damage. It is not possible to play football safely or boxing. They will look back. One of these days when we get to a system of justice, they will look back and say, that is beastly. My goodness. Ugh. Moving forward to justice with no football and no boxing. Let's see. Next on the list. Dr. Horn will be here on Wednesday. Excited. Looking forward. Man, talking about books that we read this week. Judith Finlayson. Parents should definitely listen to that program and or read the book. If you are thinking about having children, listen to the program and or read the book. Wow, that segment on, they called it the other COVID-19. Children that have gained. Can you imagine being 10, 12, 13, anywhere in that range, and gaining 20 pounds at that age over whatever your healthy, you know, body weight should be? Oh. Man, and Cheetos, we hear the usual culprits. Cheetos, when I heard that segment, I'm not serious at all. We've had Cows listeners for a good year now who have said, people who see me post food pictures on social media or, you know, the retreats where I've cooked some things, I've said, oh man, Gus, you should do a cookbook. You should do a counter-racist cookbook. You should do a counter-racist cookbook. And I've never thought of myself as a cook or had any interest in doing a cookbook, but I jokingly said I was bragging, posting about my banana pudding, made it with shortbread cookies. The most recently, it was lethal, like eat the whole bowl and not share a spoonful, lethal. And I said the cookbook I could write would be how I survived the Rona eating banana pudding and sweet potato pie without getting tubby. That was the joking title for my cookbook. And then when I hear a report like that, like I'd heard, you know, lots of people talking about how they'd gain weight. I'd known people who struggled with that because they'd just been cooped up in the house and exactly what they said, Cheetos and eating and blah, 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 and all the rest of it, not getting any exercise. All I can say, I do not think, I could be wrong, I don't think it would be possible to sit around the house and gain a whole lot of weight eating a mostly plant-based diet. Like, if you are super sedentary, I mean, I'm not saying you could certainly go and get vegan ice cream and all that stuff, but I mean, if you're eating like fruits, vegetables, you're not just sitting around and going and getting vegan ice cream every day and vegan potato chips and all the vegan, you know, Oreo cookies and all that, like you're just eating fruits, vegetables, I don't think you are going to put on 20 pounds. Like, you would have to do some super, super overeating and just total nut. Like, I just sit on the couch and eat, you know, dates and rice and beets all day long. I don't do anything. I don't think you would be able to put on all that weight eating a mostly the Cheetos and stuff. That's why I say it really has to. And those Cheetos, read the ingredients. Dr. Lathan talked about that. Judith Finlayson, the rhyming there. They both talked about that. All those chemicals, the additives that mess up your gut flora, talked about that. And they have all those addictive properties, so you just gotta eat the whole bag and then go get it. That's how they magically appear. You just eat the whole bag and then you go get another, and then, dang, I've gained 20 pounds just sitting around eating nonsense. that is criminal. If you have children, like, that's another thing, like, really being serious about children, really being serious about nutrition. Like, I'm not going to sit here and have my child watching me with orange fingerprints all over the house because I've been wolfing down Cheetos. That is not going to happen. My child is not going to get Cheetos because we are not going to have Cheetos in the house. Being serious about nutrition, serious as an attempted counter-racist parent. But I mean, wow, like that, just what we just read with Judith Finlayson, like that one kind of, it can resonate. I can remember and think vividly being in school and all the pressure and everything that you have to deal with anyway. And then you've been out of school for a year and then you come back and eat well, use logic, man, food is so important. Next, Cheetos, don't eat Cheetos. We had the report on the so-called reparations program in Evanston. When I posted the report online, a person commented, Gus, I'm in Chicago, and the headline is misleading in the story, mainly because this reparations that was agreed upon is basically a low-income housing program. That's their interpretation. Y'all were able to hear, like, the money can be, from the way that it sounded to me, it was setting aside this $25,000 for black people who can prove, you know, they have family members who lived in that specific time frame, lived in the Evanston area, and they can have this. I think it was, the grant was like $25,000, and it can be used for home improvements or purchase or upkeep, whatever it is, maintenance, all of that. It doesn't seem like they're just giving you $25,000. It seems like they have very strict confines about how the money can be allocated, or maybe they don't even give you funds. Maybe they just, you know, you just send them the bill and they cover it up to that $25,000 point. But yeah, that is interesting. You heard the report. Folks can give their thoughts on that one. I'm sure Pamela Evans Harris would have had quite a bit to say about that segment as well. I am reminded Chicago did some sort of reparations, and they used the word reparations as well in response to John Birch, a white terrorist who brutalized decades of black males, put electric shocks on their testicles in Chicago. They also offered some sort of reparations program with that as well. You have to go and read the details what all that is about. Let's see. The Rona passport, vaccine passport segment that they discussed, I thought was super important for a number of reasons. One, just I think last week we had a number of callers in a number of different geographic locations throughout the U.S. report the same thing. They saw crowds of white people, almost exclusively white people, going to get the vaccine. Even I think we had at least one person report it was in an area, in a so-called black area, where it's mostly black residents are allowed to stay there, but it was still a throng of white people. What are they doing? What's going on? Oh, they're getting their vaccine. That is corroborated with many of the news reports in terms of it's been disproportionate access, not because every black person is running around Tuskegee, Nurse Rivers, can't get the shot, because it's been white, and white people cheating. That's what I've seen. You heard some of that in the report. White people who weren't even eligible. We had someone who wrote in for work, neutralizing workplace racism yesterday, and they said the same thing, that they had a white person on their job who wasn't even in the group that should have access at this point, and somehow, what they call, skip the line, rule breakers, lots of that from what I've seen. So if they have some sort of vaccine passport or what have you, wow. I mean, talk about, I was thinking of Invisible Man and being on a plantation. Sometimes you have to have your papers in order to be allowed to leave. Like, wow. Like, I know we have some people who do not want to get the vaccine, even if they're not eligible. So, man, like that. And I would even see a lot of white people. Even pause right there. They shared that Black people, there's no difference statistically between Black people's hesitancy and white people. They had a number of reports this week that said that, and in fact, they said the group that is most hesitant, and they did the same pattern that I've said, the only group that gets racialized in all of this is Black people. I've seen Black and Latina people a few times, but in terms of the hesitation, it's been overwhelmingly and almost exclusively Black people. They said the group that is most hesitant, Republican males. Couldn't even on that one say, yeah, it seems like white men don't want to get the shot here. What's going? No. I guess maybe it could be Herman Cain the late. Maybe he doesn't want to get a vaccine or Republican male. And again, what's their excuse? I don't see all that attention on what is up with them. What is wrong with you all? Did President Trump have that much of an impact? And what is going? None of that sort of thing. Just keep going back to harp on Black people. Difficult to make truth of things at times. Moving forward. Loved hearing Dr. Welsing, her talk about the people who are going to die from the mandatory violence and gun violence specifically of white supremacy racism, and then corroborated in the report from this week. I thought about that I think there have been a number of reports over the past year, kind of since the Rona thing started in the U.S., about increase in number of firearms and then increase in the number of Black people with firearms. I do not see that necessarily being anything constructive with all of the conflict and what have you, that white people can easily keep going with us if they're not the ones who instigated themselves. A lot of times, non-white people being violent with other non-white people, that happens frequently, and or just white people directly being violent with Black people. They'll encourage and say, oh my goodness, they were armed, so we, you know, that sort of thing. But I was not too surprised to hear that from the final report. I thought it was important, but not too surprising in a system of white supremacy racism. All of that said, before we nab our callers, I will make sure to get in. I do have a newfound respect for Neely Fuller Jr. when he says, I may be in error unless I've been misinformed. I think having that, my perception of that is having some form of humility. I think he says all the time, I am not an expert. He said it on this here program many, many times. I am not an expert. And I think that's so important. I try to reflect that as well. I do not qualify as an expert on racism, white supremacy. I state that all the time. If I talk about parenting and what have you, I don't have children. Nothing else to qualify. I'm not an expert on child rearing, so I don't want to sit up here and sound like that. I think that is so important. System of white supremacy, the number one weapon is deception. Counter racism should be about accuracy. Strive for accuracy. That's something I've been saying on the program for years. That's something I try to do. That is a lofty goal. It is difficult in an environment of deception. It is difficult to be consistently accurate. That is the goal. In my view, there is a lot of talking where folks are speaking as though they have some sort of expertise that they do not have. That is not helpful at all. I've said that specifically, like with the whole COVID-19 situation. Oh, let me put the descriptors on it. I find it disgraceful, repugnant, repulsive. I could add a whole lot more, but I'll stop there. People that are not doctors, not medical professionals speaking with a level of authority as though they are certain this is confirmed information. You don't have lab the first. You can have an opinion. We all have our opinion, VGQ, but I mean, woo, counter-racism should be about evidence-based opinions. And in my view, like, humility. I am not an expert in this field. I can read information and come to a conclusion, but hey, I am not a medical professional. I will at least pause until I can speak with someone who might have a bit more expertise than myself, unless I have some training, I have done some studying as a medical professional. That, I think, is extremely important. Striving for accuracy, having some humility when we make our presentations to share our views about whatever it is we're going to discuss. That, man, it might be that racists might have got me. That has happened to me. I have said that I've had to come on and acknowledge, like, man, I made an error. I can think of tons of them over the years. Cory Booker, thinking he had a white parent, folks had to correct me. Strive for accuracy. Probably make some more today. The New York Times makes errors. NPR makes errors. Washington Post makes errors. Everyone makes errors. The goal is still strive for accuracy. And again, at least for me, let's not pontificate on subject matter with expertise that we don't have. And I can insert one of my favorite lines. If you like the cows, so what? If you don't like the cows, so what? The goal is still replace white supremacy with justice. Strive for accuracy. That's it for this broadcast. If we could refrain from using metaphors, that is one reason right there why I discourage the use of metaphors on this program. I have many reasons, but one, in a system of white supremacy, racism that is primarily operated by deception, one of the ways that you combat deception is being precise with words. Metaphors are designed, intended to be imprecise. They leave a lot of what you call it guesswork. Subjective can have many different interpretations. In fact, sometimes people don't even know what you're talking about. They're just confused. But that's one of the reasons. Metaphors can allow for a lot of deception because you're not being very specific about what it is that you are saying. One of the metaphors we got this week, they were talking about so-called anti-Asian violence, and they got to the end of the segment and they said it's difficult to try to get some sort of resolution to this problem because it's in the country's bloodstream. What a metaphor. Like, I would need that explained. What do you mean? But I hear that sort of metaphor frequently where racism, white supremacy gets described as some sort of biological affliction. But that one was towards the end there, in my bloodstream. If for this broadcast, if we could be precise, specific, no metaphors, much obliged. I will prompt about the metaphors. If you need additional time to kind of get your words together, choose them accurately. That is always appreciated and allowed. Let's see. The number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take 5 minutes when you share, that would be awesome. Just to make sure everyone gets an opportunity to speak. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be greatly appreciated so we don't have to battle with unnecessary background noise and other people talking and the like. They're watching the NCAA tournament and all that jazz. Just use your mute button. If you can get to a quieter area, make your thoughts, and then you can mute your line. Much obliged. *61 if you have commentary to share. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Oh, trying to still compensate. One of my errors from earlier this week, I got confused. I thought it was Thomas in New York, and it was not. It was Vegan RD. Sorry about that. Rachel in New York, my apologies, but she is listening in live now. Good to hear her still with us. Let's see. Folks who dialed in with the hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Bay Area mom. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I took notes this time. Let's see. How do I want to... I'm going to connect all of this to my son that's in Boston. So you did a... there was a clipping with the... what is it? Kim Janey, the Boston mayor. Well, she's mayor because the other mayor is he's under Biden's cabinet. I forgot what he's secretary of. Anyway, I asked him about that. He said, "Oh yeah, I heard about her." So I guess she's acting mayor, so I don't know if they'll vote her out when they start, you know, doing their running. I just thought her story was interesting and typical. With the eating disorders and the unhealthy lifestyles, the clip you did with the lady that was, I guess with the kids going back to school and... a lot of them, because they've been sitting at home doing whatever, they've picked up a couple of pounds. And then the clip you threw in from Halle Berry, that movie, shoot, that horrible movie. I remember that. And I do think that's a lot of parents' fear, is the children being so overweight that they'll be overweight children and get terrorized and then be mistreated as overweight adults. So sometimes I would try to work on my son to make sure he's not eating himself into a balloon. Vaccine passports. So my son asked me about, because they remember he has those three white roommates, 2.5, however it's going. So they went and got, they're the cheaters. They're cheaters. So there's this application I guess you have to fill out that's mandatory, that you have to, I don't remember what it is, but it's something he had to fill out to see where he would fit in as far as getting the vaccine. So I said, just take the weekend and go over it. Don't just fill it out real quick. Read it, study it, and then fill it out, because that was mandatory, just fill it out. So the white kids lied on theirs to say they were overweight and had all kind of health issues, so they can get theirs first. So they went and got their first dose, I guess, last week. Well, maybe it will be this week. So they got their first dose. And so, hey, did you get your shot? Well, no, I haven't gotten anything back to go get it, because I guess the way you fill it out is the how quick you are to you can go get your shot permission. So well, why don't you just fill out another application and say that you have health issues so you can get the shot? And I told him, I was like, you better not do that. So you got two different conflicting applications. Just stop it. So we're just trying to be safe. You know, we just want everybody to be safe. So they want to get, they rush to get their shots so they can do stuff, because they think that once you get the shot, everything is safe and you can just go out and live free and do what you want to do, go to parties, take your mask off. And I said, so with that, they're very reckless. So you need to social distance just in general from them. stop eating their food or however you guys are doing food, because if they're that reckless thinking that this is what that shot is going to do, and they've only got the first shot, they didn't get the second one, you completely social distance. And then, you know, you go out, do your walks, do whatever you got to do, meditate, and stay away from these kids. He's like, yeah, now I see why you didn't want me to do so. Everything that we've talked about before, now he sees. But he also says that he's glad that he did do it, so he'll have the experience versus not having it and just going from whatever he was told. So now he knows that he's living it. And I think that's it. He was saying something about the vaccine passport, because you get to travel, but he's not really interested in traveling right now. And I told him, if worse comes to worse, I'll come get you. And school's not that important. I don't want to be rude, but it's not worth you getting a vaccine right this second. That's just my take. So I'll mute my line, and thanks for taking my call.
Wow. Great attempted mom looking out for her child. That is amazing. That's in the archives for Neutralizing Workplace Racism, where we talked to her. Her son talked about his living situation for the next year at college up in Massachusetts. We talked about it like the day, because it could be three white people. She said two and a half because we got a racially ambiguous person. So, you know, this could be just three white people. We don't know. But we'll say three suspected racists in the living situation. And we talked about, you know, are they taking this seriously? And said, oh, yeah, no visitors and all of that. So we're only at, it's not even April yet officially. And wow. And more white cheaters. That's what I've seen consistently. It hasn't been black people don't want to get it and they're scared and dumb and blah, blah, blah. It's been white cheaters. They had reports of some white ladies. They were like 20, really young, and they tried to dress up like they were in their 80s to go get the shot. Like, I guess before we pivot to the next call, a Bay Area mom is, so is your offspring, your child, is he gonna get this? I guess at whatever the appropriate time when he's supposed to get it, for people that are, I guess, at a lower risk level, is he just gonna get it later, or are you just saying, you know, hey, I don't trust it, you know, don't worry about doing the shot?
Oh, no, he's not going to get the shot. If I have to go get him, he's not going to get the shot.
Okay. Wow, that is that's a radically different housing situation if he's not going to be vaccinated. And if they're already being reckless and they just got shot one, they haven't even gotten the second shot yet, and it's already free-for-all back to, you know, good old times on the college campus. Like, yikes. I don't have a sound clip of it, but Neely Fuller Jr., white people can show you better than I can tell you. That right there is why I do not try to convince anyone that all white people are racist. None of the above. I ask the question, what does it mean to be white? Some things you just have to learn for yourself. *61. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, greetings everyone, greetings guys. I wanted to comment on two things. The first story about the Boston mayor, I thought it was very interesting that they started off with first woman, and it wasn't until the end of the story that she also said first woman and first black.
person that's the mayor. I think I thought that was very interesting that it was started off as a woman, and we don't even get to see that she's the first Black person to be mayor until later on. I also thought the reparation story was pretty interesting in that it seems like the people really aren't getting anything. Evanston, Illinois, is a college town, which would be, to me, seem like a very expensive place to live already. And when I think of college towns, I think of mostly like gentrification. I looked it up, and the average house in Evanston is about almost $400,000. So it seems like, I don't know what $25,000 would do for someone to help them pay. Like, there's no way that they can pay off the other $375,000 for that home. So I thought that was very interesting. On top of the fact that I think they just kind of set up a trap, knowing that housing is so expensive there, that even if they would give them $25,000, it wouldn't be able to provide housing for those people. So I thought that was pretty interesting. That's it for now.
Much obliged, ma'am. That area is very expensive. That is a excellent point. Northwestern is there, the university, and I believe Northwestern is private. I'll have to investigate. I could be in error, but it is expensive. Like, wow. Yeah, and I could see the folly, because they talked about that. This could maybe become a model for how we have a national reparations program. I think that's why the person wrote in and said this is just like a really like slipshod low income housing program. I said that was what their interpretation of it was. So yeah. Reparations. Let's see, other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed. Let's see, while folks are...
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. I'm a caller from Los Angeles. I just wanted to be helpful and give the name of a Black female who was executed in Virginia. Her name was Virginia Christian, I believe, and I'll mute my line for now. Thank you.
Spectacular, spectacular. Virginia Christian, yes. The Commonwealth executed for being convicted of killing a white woman. Shameful. And I think that program was back 2018. I think it was a white man who wrote like a fictional account of, you know, all of this and what may have happened that ended with her execution. But yes, much obliged. Thank you for filling in. Virginia Christian, abolition of the death penalty in the Commonwealth this week, courtesy of the Coon Man, Governor Ralph Northam. Like, nobody, remember they were talking about what you call it, like having him resign about this time 2 years ago, and now he's abolishing the death penalty. Like, he could even be lined up for president if they say Joe Biden doesn't want to run again in 2024. I think he said this week he was going to run again, but if, you know, if he changes his mind, Governor Northam right there. Coon man. Let's see. Other folks dialed in. They have commentary to share. Line should be open. Proceed. Let's see. While folks are getting their thoughts together, I thought we had a request. Several folks said, hey, Gus, for the book club, we should do some of these manifestos. Elliot Roger, Dylan Stormroof, Anders Breivik, all these folks, you know, even Christopher Dorner, Dr. Welsing was talking about him. All these folks had manifestos that were attributed to them. Elliot Roger, I believe, is the only person where the police actually reported they authenticated. Yes, he wrote this. I don't know the process, how they authenticated, but that's what they reported. We should read Elliot Roger, his manifesto, once we complete Geronimo Pratt, Last Man Standing, the biography that we're reading right now. We have a ways to go still, but it's not one page, but it's not something that would take months to read. I think it's like 140 pages, so probably less than a month. We could be done, but with all the focus, so-called anti-Asian violence, and people saying even they went back and listened to that program because of the recent reports, we should do that manifesto in the book club because it is fascinating. And Dr. Welsing, she did strongly recommend that document be studied for what he had to say. I remember reading it in total and highlighting it so that we could talk about it, but it's been some years. If you did not download it, read it way back when, perhaps coming to the Cows Book Club sometime this year. We will see. Let's see. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate.
Oh, may I be heard?
A caller in Florida, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I was reminded of the news segments that I saw earlier in the week when I was listening to the Miami area, or the so-called spring break going down or going on down in Miami. I thought about once again the comparative difference when, because we had the Super Bowl down here, right? So, you know, Tom Brady being called quote unquote the GOAT, and you know, he got this many rings. There was partying then. It was mostly white, from my understanding. Maybe some non-white people in around this same area, maybe a little further up in the state, Tampa. And then there was white people, some from my area and Orlando, a lot of other areas. They were around partying, being belligerent, defiant, not adhering to the rules or the protocols. And now all of a sudden, within the past couple of days, you see darker complected people, black people, and they're using terms like crackdown, you know, on the news. And that's exactly the term I was thinking of, the SWAT vehicle. And I think on the segment they had asked the person, you know, did you know who ordered these, the SWAT vehicle, the SWAT van or something like that? And the person was like, I don't know. And then throwing pepper bombs or whatever, I think that's what it's called, some kind of projectile. And it's more viciousness and lack of value on the people when they are black. And that gentleman had it correct when he was saying, when it's black people, that's just doing regular things that don't warrant this kind of force. And I also thought about, hey, where was that when it was the Capitol riots? You know, two other things. In my area, they did a book signing on, I can't remember what the name of the book was, but it has like a compiled, list of letters from Black mothers who have lost their sons or brothers or uncles, Black males, to police. I guess they said police brutality, race soldiers, basically. And I think one of the mothers was the mother of Eric Garner. So I thought that was interesting as well. And they had a anti-Asian rally downtown as well. I didn't really know about it. I just found out from the news. And I think it's interesting as well when it comes to racism, you know, I really can't really put together, like, what act of racism is happening between, you know, what groups. And, you know, the white supremacists are very skilled on how they have different groups, like, not just physically distant from each other, like in different residential areas, and just the experiences as well. And it's just been something I've really been thinking about, and I'm glad that you have been playing the audio segments with the violence and the acts of mistreatment going on against non-white people. And it's been giving me something to think about. So other than that, that's pretty much all I have to share. And thanks for allowing me to speak.
Black male privilege, for the piece of literature that I heard, a book where the topic is Black males who have been slaughtered by enforcement officers, race soldiers. Like, that is an appetizing coffee table book for your house. Black male privilege. I know our caller at the courthouse didn't insinuate. Yes, sir. I know our caller at the courthouse didn't insinuate that he wanted the police to use pepper grenades on the great Tom Brady. I mean, you know, if you got some Negro hooligans out for spring break, you know, hey, let's put the chokehold and nigger knocker, all of them. Tom Brady, he could be doing crack cocaine in the street, and we're not going to do any pepper spraying. And him and Gronk, they can own this whole city. You are talking crazy, even suggest such a thing. Hush. Let's see. Was that you, Thomas, in New York?
No, sir.
Oh, okay. Oh, retired firefighter.
I think missed you met it. Me.
Oh. I'm all over the place. See, told you, I make tons of errors myself. Well, I guess we did get the female call. I did hear retired firefighter first, but and I did botch the other day. We had Rachel in New York. She was right there to share, and I messed up completely. Did you want to share?
Yes,
ma'am. Go ahead.
So I wanted to talk about the eating disorders. Clip. I agree that parents have control over what their children eat. And I think it's important to provide healthy items in your home and not to bring in unhealthy items. Like, what I try to do is, like, if I go out with my child or children, I will probably buy them something that possibly might be unhealthy if that's the only option. But in my home, I make most of the options healthy. That's all I wanted to add.
So important. Like, man, just because, I mean, that's like the foundation. Like, so many people, the foods that they love and foods that they get excited about are foods that they grew up eating, and sometimes foods that their grandparents ate or that their parents ate. So if it's so important that you, as an attempted parent, eat well, and then exactly as she said, what yumminess you bring in the house, making sure Cheetos don't magically appear and all kinds of other crazy edible non-food items with food coloring and all that other, you know, craziness. Fruits, veggies, eat well. I know it can't be a I don't have children, but I know it can be a challenge when you have to travel and go out and do errands and things, like, and especially if you have younger children, like, man, it can be a real challenge. But yeah, just having the routine so that all we have at home is healthy items. If we have any parents who have any tips for how you manage going out and avoiding as much of the craziness as you can, that would be appreciated. Retired firefighter, much obliged for your patience, sir.
Still learning. I would figure, greetings, Guts, and greetings to everyone. I would figure that Mr. Brown would probably protect Mr. Brady. Being that, from my understanding, he resided in his house for at least partially the football season. I don't know how long, but that's something that I heard, and I think he's grateful for it. As far as the issues down here in South Florida, South Beach, to be exact. Myself and a law enforcement official that I'm quite close to, we kind of like predicted what everybody is hearing about. It didn't take a whole lot of study and experiences to be able to figure that out. Miami Beach as a whole, let alone talking about South Beach, had been a sundown town for decades. My mother's oldest sister worked in South Beach, the South Beach area, I would say in and around the 40s, in the 50s. And when she passed, you know how you people, you know, divide up the different trinkets and whatnot that the person had amongst family members. And we have possession of a passport that a non-white black person had to have to enter into Miami Beach. And you better have that on you or you are subject to arrest. It has never been, as I mentioned before, welcomed to non-white black people. If you ask me on why is so many people still want to frolic over there, I couldn't give you a good answer. So there it is, you know, as far as the problems that takes place. Spring break down here in South Florida was first known in Fort Lauderdale. There was a famous movie that came out in 1960 called Where the Boys Are, that featured that spring break, and that was with white people, white young people from colleges and universities in the northern areas when it was snowing and whatnot, that sort of thing. In this part of the world, there is a practice of non-white black people picking up things from white people as far as being entertained by, and it developed into something that we identify as having fun. That may have something to do with the interests. They have, they meaning the law enforcement as well as professional politicians, I would say for the most part are white people. Basically have shut that down curfew is somewhere around 6 to 8 o'clock p.m., something like that. It can easily be controlled because to get to those places, you have to go through something that's called a causeway, which is a relatively narrow way from City of Miami to the Miami Beach area. There's about three or four of them that law enforcement can easily quarantine the passageways east to west if they wanted to. And so as far as now, it's not that many people with the activities that everybody's been seeing now. That I mentioned to you, I looked it up, and the University of Northwestern is a private institution, according to what I've just saw on my phone. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. I remember it being very expensive. Like, oh my, like 25,000. That was what I was, that was why I brought up Northwestern. Northwestern is in Evanston, but I didn't, before I got to get any of the details, right? I didn't know what the reparations was going to be. I didn't know if they were just cutting people a check or what. I said, wow, Evanston. I wonder if they're just going to let all of the black people that live there go to Northwestern for free. Like, hey, that, you know, maybe you could work that out. Like, you can go stay as long as you want, like become, you know, get 50 PhDs or whatever. Like, that's workable. That's, you know, mild start. Like, go sign up for the, that was what I was thinking. Like, go sign, but no, that they're not going to do anything crazy like that. Let's see. The caller at 0526. Did you have commentary? Just listening, or we're not hearing you. 0526. Maybe they're just listening. We'll check again. As for the Miami situation, man, the SWAT, as much as we've talked about that with the Black Panther Party and all the like, I've seen, this is like going back all the way to March 2020, when all this began. The New York Times, many other outlets, they had many, many reports when it was white people invading Florida and other like tourist vacation, warm tourist spots, and saying, you know, forget all that, it's spring break, we're going out to party. They didn't do any of that. It wasn't SWATing and pepper grenades and all the rest. They didn't do any of that. And it happened again this year. They did the. I even posted some of the early photos in the beginning part when it was like first couple weeks of March. It was, it looked like the exact same group of people. Lots of individuals who would be classified as white. Maybe one person in there who, you know, one black person or whatever, but overwhelmingly white crowd out doing it all. No distancing, no mask, all of that. This week, the people in the images, substantially more melanin. Like, it was crowds of black people, and you could see carloads, you could see the faces, prominently featured black people. And then it was SWATing, grenades, rocket launchers, and all the rest. Who decided this? I don't know. SWAT just showed up and had neighbors, so we figured SWATing. Like, incidentally, with all of that, I think I've been saying for about a year, hunker down. If I had a child, a nephew, a niece, a cousin, they were in school and they said, hey, Uncle Gus or whatever it is, going for spring break. Like, whoa, for lots of reasons. Like, whoa, maybe you should reconsider. You just saw the Robert Aaron Long SWAT team is on the beach. Like, lots of reasons to rethink all of that. Like, I know being young and everything, but I mean, it is not the best time to be partying, especially if you're going someplace where it might, either or, if it's a lot of black people or a lot of white people, it's dangerous either way. Sad times, very sad. 720-716-7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The caller 1159.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings, everyone. This is 0526. I don't know why my mic isn't working on the computer, but the beginning of the broadcast about the race soldiers were so fitting, because me and my cellmate and my little brother survived a terrifying encounter with race soldiers today. And the clip with the white guy saying I ran that nigger over, and the broadcast about more black people and non-white people being injured and killed by vehicles reminded me of the scene from this movie Toxic Avengers, where they're playing a game where running over black people you get a certain amount of points. So those are my comments. Thank you.
Very important, the pedestrians being struck even with less traffic on the road. They said they had similar reports in 2014 right close to me in Oregon, saying that they did an analysis of how long it took people to go through a crosswalk, and it took black people substantially longer to cross. People weren't as willing to allow them to cross, surprisingly. And in fact, that's in Monsters Ball. Halle Berry's black son, obese, gets killed, hit by a vehicle, walking home or walking, you know, wherever he's going. But that's right in the middle. That's what they call it, sets the stage for the tragic arrangement, her son getting ran over by a vehicle. And it was a hit and run too. They don't even get the white person who killed her child. Much obliged, dear sir. I hope you all are safe. I think you did say you had a terroristic event today. Did I miss that? Like, I don't want to bury that. Did you say you had a terroristic event today, you and your brother?
Yeah, and my cellmate, we were questioned by race soldiers who asked us if we heard gunshots and if we lived in this area. I was just very much on code, and we survived, but it was definitely terroristic and terrifying, to say the least.
My apologies. Like, wow. Glad you all got through it safely. Take excellent care. Do some things that are restorative and nourishing for you. He said cellmate. Plantation, the cell, that is where we are. Much obliged, caller in California. Thomas in New York, was that you?
Yes, it was, Gus. Good evening. Good evening to all the callers.
Can I pause 1 second?
On your commentary earlier.
Can I ask a question before you get started?
Sure.
Okay. Did I, at any point this week, really at any time, accuse you of spreading so-called conspiracy theories?
Not directly, no.
Okay. I would like that retracted, because you said that I said Thomas is spreading conspiracy theories, and that's not what I said. I would like that retracted, please.
If I did say it, I'll retract it. If I said it, I'll retract it, because you didn't say it. No. And I'm not going to harp on it. You didn't say that.
Much obliged. This is the compensatory call-in. Words, very important. I just say that because I don't use that word, conspiracy theory. I don't use it for many reasons. But the reason I requested a retraction What I did say was that you had said things that were inaccurate, and I would not let anyone accuse me of charging them with conspiracy theories if what I said was what the person said was not accurate. Strive for accuracy. Very important. Proceed, Thomas in New York.
Sure, but what you said wasn't quite accurate, but okay. I watched two separate interviews recently. Vidico and Larry Holmes. And both of them exuded tendencies of boxers who have CTE, delayed answers, slurred words, very carefree responses. To answer your question, Yonkers, if you're in the Bronx and you cross the street, you're in Yonkers. It's right there. Pretty much known for producing hip-hop stars, DMX, Mary J. Blige, etc. The white person word, the only word a white person can call a black person, worse than nigga or sambo, I think, that would exude a emotional response from the black person would be slave. I think that would trigger, not to use it as a metaphor, but just... it will set it off, set that black person off, because it's accurate. Now, I'm not an expert on energy. They send me a bill, I pay it. I don't own a home. I live in an apartment. If you do and you can't afford it, I would say get a Tesla Powerwall or a Generac and a solar system to attach to it, and keep adding more of those units until you're energy independent or at least able to power the essential electrical needs. Therefore, phase out fossil fuel. As they phase out fossil fuels for green energy, if there's any failures to the green energy, you'll still have energy. The most powerful white people in persons here in the North America, including the governments, of the United States, Canada, et cetera, are fully invested in what they call Grid 2030. And they even have IEEE protocols for the grid already. There's plenty of information out there. Even getting coins, cryptocurrencies that have carbon credits attached to them that will be worth something in the future. At this point in society, I think that it's so advanced. How hard could it be to give prisoners access to a smartphone that they are responsible for the upkeep of, and it can be regulated and monitored easily by the prison, disabled at a specific time and enabled at a specific time. It just seems a little bit like a money grab to have these major corporations profiting off of these prisoners using the phones. In some cases, they can't. I don't use social media. I don't want to agree to the terms. Google already makes me accept those terms and permissions to use the Android system to operate my phone. And Samsung makes me agree to those same terms. To give them full capabilities of my phone so I can use their phone service. So, their phone hardware, rather. So now Facebook and Twitter, after all these years, need to police their platforms for disinformation. If you notice, this started with Trump. And it only pertains to political issues. Facebook was caught working with Cambridge Analytica to put out disinformation specifically to target specific users based off of their likes, dislikes, posts, and reposts, etc. And in particular, the disinformation that Russia colluded in the 2016 election, which led to the Mueller investigation, which also included race-targeted propaganda
all of this information, the Cambridge Analytica thing, brought Zuckerberg to testify in the Senate, if you wanted to look all that up. This is, in my opinion, fascism. Technology companies in collusion with the neoliberal politicians to suppress information from the public that is other than the information they want the public to have. And I find that to be very something that needs to be looked at. And lastly, over 18 people dead in two mass shootings, and one of them had six Asian women as victims. Two top stories in New York media, the benchmark of global media, this week was Miami Beach spring break, the drinking and the twerking young victims, and the people who, a person who punched an Asian woman in the face. He looked black, even though he probably classified as Latino. But no mentions of this mass shooter or anything for 5 days here. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
The Colorado shooting. I forgot. I meant to ask the folks in, or just the people that are with us. This is a quick one since we're almost done. We can wrap things up. The shooter in Colorado. Do people think he is classified as a white person or a non-white person? Ahmad Alisa, if people have seen him, video of the person that they have in custody charged with the shooting in Colorado, do people think he is a white person, non-white person?
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter.
My first glimpse of him... somebody described his name, and I kind of like assumed that it was a non-white person, but when I really studied his facial features, absent the color of his hair and the hairiness on his body, I just factored in that he is probably a white person. As a non-white person, you know there's no non-white people who are experts on that subject. I would assume, regardless of what his name is and where his origin's from, because white people are born in Asia every day, I would say, that's a white person.
Okay, we got one for white. The way that they reported his name in many of the original reports was Ahmad Al-Aliwi Alisa. So if you just saw that in print, that might give you one bit of information, and then you see an actual photograph, might give you different information. So that's one for after he saw and did some study, retired firefighter says white man. Anybody else? White, non-white, shooter in Colorado? You're a little low. If you could speak up, please.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I don't know. Okay. I just did a quick Google search of the shooter, and just from my opinion, looking at him, I will put him as a white suspected racist. With that, I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, sir. We got white suspected racist. Retired firefighter says white. Any other folks? Do we think the Colorado shooting suspect, white person, non-white person?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I've seen pictures and I would suspect him to be a racist suspect, white supremacist. And to comment on the article, the broadcast that you played about him, they did such a, and the Asian spa shooter, they did such a cringe-inducing job of not mentioning race until at the very end. And it seemed like they were nervous talking about it because the white people know what's going on, but they don't disclose that to the world. So that's it.
Many non-white people get killed just for speaking about racism, white supremacy. So it is certainly something to, as they call it, get the jitters talking about. Gus T speaking, you know, from my own experience as well. Okay, so that's three. That's three suspected racist, I think. Three suspected racist.
Well, what, Gus, what is your opinion?
I think suspected racist. I think I'd go, I think this is a white. Now, I will say, I was thinking white person, even though I looked at the name, but I looked at the picture and I said, I think this is a white man. I was scrolling down and I'm trying to go to find the exact report. And they were talking to all these different people in high school. And they were saying, oh, he was an angry guy and he was mean and he had a temper and blah, 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 and all this other stuff. And he got to one point and he said that, Okay. He said on a Facebook page that appeared to belong to Elisa and has since been removed, the user posted in 2019 that he believed his former high school was hacking his cell phone. In a comment to someone who asked why the school would do that, he blamed racism. I believe part racism for sure, he replied. I believe someone spread rumors about me, which are false, and maybe that set it off. So that, I read that, and I did pause for a moment to be like, what? No, this is just a white person saying that he's a victim and, you know, whatever. So, but I did give a pause with him saying that he thought racism was being practiced against them, but against him. But many white people say that, too. So at this point, unless I get different information or can see some other photographs or, you know, they talk about this in court, I'm going that this is a white man suspected racist. I also find it interesting. I don't know if they have been, like they say, the Robert Aaron Long, white man. Like, I see that in many reports. I have not seen, like, explicit clarification about his racial identification. If anybody has, please share. Anybody else? White, non-white?
Yeah, I think he's white. I think that Colorado, I mean, from Columbine, the movie theater, and now this, something about that area.
Unanimous thus far. Anybody else think he's... Now, they, Fox News, they identified him as a 21-year-old Middle Eastern resident. That is for sure not a racial classification, so... Immigrant from Syria. Almost reminds me of the shooting up in Boston, the Tsarnaev brothers. We had the same conversation there almost, but I think it was, or I don't want to presume. I think I was of the opinion these are white people maybe, but I think we had a discussion with a guest. She said no, they would not have classified themselves as white, but yeah, I think some people thought they were white, too. Anyway, anybody else? Colorado shooter, white, non-white? We got unanimous so far. We think he's white.
Yeah, I was going to say what you said, that he seems to hail from Syria, which is a country that borders Greece and other places. And I think that him claiming racism is maybe some sort of manipulation tool, because maybe he's talking about his status as an immigrant or xenophobia, but whatever happened to him wasn't racist. He seems to function as a white person to me.
That's what I thought. Rachel in New York, Denver, CBS Local. They have a report, 1911 caller described the shooter as a white male, middle age, dark hair. Just looking at me, because I just haven't seen, like I said, with Robert Aaron Long, pretty consistently and across a spectrum of platforms, I see him identified as a white man, white man, white man. This fella, even if they said non-white, I think, okay, that give me something more to think about. But, I guess hope they'll have a trial, so maybe this will come up and we'll get more information. In the meantime, no racial identification. Have to keep looking. In the meantime, Dr. Gerald Horn, I am so excited. Like, such a good book. The Bittersweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing. Floyd Mayweather Jr. is mentioned. Muhammad Ali, Marvin Hagler. And it's all about racism. Even Donald Trump, it's all about, I totally forgotten, Donald Trump is such a huge boxing fan. He writes in the book, Trump Plaza, they had all these infamous fights. Mike Tyson knocked all those people out at Trump Plaza. He's at the, not that I'm encouraging people to watch boxing, I'm just saying. When Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao finally fought, I think Floyd Mayweather, hundreds of millions of dollars he made, one of the largest purses ever. Donald Trump is right, almost front row, right there behind, Floyd Mayweather's corner. But he talks about that in the book, Donald Trump and many other presidents, their fascination with boxing and all the racists, gangsters' fascination with boxing. Might be a great time if you want to watch one of Mr. Fuller's favorites, Godfather 2, out in the desert. But I am super excited. Dr. Gerald Horn back with us on Thursday. White guests only, but I did say we would have exceptions. This book is a great reason for an exception. All of that said, man, you have to check in with our young man in Boston. That was, wow. That is, it's been months. Yeah, he just got there, and to have all that turbulence, we'll have to check in with him and see. I said that maybe we could check in and get maybe two or three reports throughout the year and kind of see, what has taken place. We'll have to check in and see how he is doing. Three white roommates who all cheated, lied to get the Rona shot. And that'll be a great point to end. Now, in that situation, whom sounds like they are most confused about white supremacy racism? Sobriety would be best under conditions of racism. We will need our brain computer. In addition to being sober, if you got, man, they got the SWAT team in Miami Beach. You got the shooter in Colorado, Robert Aaron Long in Georgia. Lots of reasons to hunker down. If you got to go out, be very alert. If it looks like anybody, they're being loud, hostile, no confrontations with strangers in public. Can't even cross the street, they said, safely. You should be thinking this rowdy person could be armed, she or he might have a dozen other friends and family members who are also armed and ready to call you a Sambo and a nigger and whatever is worse than that. Slave, if anybody, I guess nobody else had any other guesses. I don't either. I don't know. But ready to do all of that and maybe even take your life. No confrontations, no verbal skirmishes, exit. That said, if you are going to go out, you are sober, buckled. If you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. Gotta be paying attention to what's happening around you. We're trying to minimize contact with the SWAT team down in Miami, Mark Furman, all the rest. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with our, I was in the middle of the pair. Mo in Dallas, she never break a pair. I didn't get to see his hand. My apologies. Mo in Dallas, we'll do my prayer correctly and get you before we go out. Mo in Dallas, did you have a commentary before we exit?
Yes, sir, I did. The shooter in Boulder, Colorado. I actually asked a white person, so I'm glad you called on me for that one. I asked a white person, and I asked him simply, white or not white? I didn't ask him that for this. And he wrote, "Syrian refugee came here already knowing what he wanted to do. closed borders are the are a great thing. Closed borders are a great thing. And I said, what color, though? And he says, dirty pale, as his answer. And I said, so white, question mark? And he said, no, not white. And I said, okay, what makes him not quite white? And I got no response. And I only asked that particular white person because this white person, I believe that she was a white person. This white person looks like he could be related to the white person I asked. Like, they look very similar. Like, I was like, wow. An earlier segment, the prison calls, it is very, very, very just wrong how the communication system does work when talking to someone in greater confinement. I have a relative, and before he can call, like, they'll like allow him to run up like a specific amount of, I guess, a tab, if you will, and then they'll like charge interest on that tab. And I think it's like 25 cents a minute in Texas. And he's very far from home. He's actually, he can see Mexico out of his, from the prison he's in. It's just, and like, we're in Dallas, so there's no way of getting to him. It's like a 17-hour drive. The conditions are bad. They're not, they put, his commissary on restriction. So even if he has money, like, he can't go but like once every 2 weeks, from what I understand. It's really wrong the way my relative, the victim, and victims like him are being treated in a greater confinement. I don't know any white people in prison, so I don't know how they're doing. That's all I have. I'm in my line.
Thought that was an important segment as well. We talked about that in the book club with Geronimo Pratt and doing all the terroristic things to distance his family so that they wouldn't visit him, so they can isolate these black males in greater confinement and really terrorize them. And I said it's even worse now because now they try to put the institutions of greater confinement in really isolated locations, sometimes out of state. So it's really far and difficult and treacherous for anyone to come see you. And I think they even said in that segment, like, just a phone call. So grounding. That was the word that he used. So grounding, just to have some sort of connection. I think they say keeping those connections, it reduces recidivism, as they call it. Repeat offenders. That's not what they want. Much obliged, Mo in Dallas. Prayer properly. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. No name calling. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm up. A victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.